Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your hosts, Craig
and Matt
Allen.
And welcome back with Fight Night Picks. As always, one half of your hosts, new Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, as always, the second half to what is Fight Night Picks, Matt Allen. You can find him on the respective socials at Matt Allen FNP. And to everybody out there tuning in, I cannot wait for this card. Coming up this weekend, we have UFC 267 coming live from Fight Island over in Abu Dhabi. This follows an absolute banger of a card that was UFC Fight Night Costa versus Vettori. And I mean, even amongst all of those fights, you had 14 of them. The one that I thought that was going to win fight of the night didn't even get a bonus whatsoever in Mason Jones and David Onama. That just tells you how good of a card that one was. And if we fast forward to this weekend, a total of 15 fights, but we got to head back and at least think a little bit about that card that we just had, because overall, a very, very fun showing, a very, very good card, and overall, we had some pretty good records, too. I mean, even the question mark kicks parlay from Fight Night Picks question mark kicks, which is always 2 hours before the prelims of every single UFC card, that one hit with Jeff Molina and the over. I guess it wasn't even an over. It was fight to go the distance between Trinaldo and Dwight Grant. Those both hit 10-3-1. It was a big-time weekend, Matt. Yes. I'm looking good forward job. To this one. Let's get into it. Let's get the trophies going.
You only grab that when you have good weeks.
I mean, listen, I'm three back now of the lead. Like, it's coming on strong. But regardless, Matt, I absolutely love this card coming up this weekend.
It felt like last weekend's card was a bit of a primer for this big pay-per-view. We've had a few underwhelming, I think it's fair to say, Fight Night cards. You know, some main events that you normally wouldn't think would be main events for Fight Night cards. But last weekend was finally one of those cards where, on paper, it might not have looked all that great other than the main event, but it delivered. We kind of got the best version of every fight, or the best version of what we thought we were going to get out of every fight. And I feel like it set up this pay-per-view perfectly, because I know a lot of people who aren't massive MMA fans who are still pretty excited about this pay-per-view, which is odd because normally you have one fighter on a pay-per-view that has multiple title fights. And let's say you'll have a Nick Diaz, or you'll have a Conor McGregor, just a Diaz brother, at least one big name, you know? This card doesn't really have one of those massive, like, A-list names, but I still feel like there's a good amount of hype surrounding it.
There's definitely an A-lister buried here, and he starts off the main card. Will we Fight Night pick him to win? We have Khamzat Chimaev, the return of the 2020 Phenom. He's taking on China's Li Jingliang, a guy who, when he's on, he's absolutely on. Look at his knockout of Santiago Ponzinibbio not that long ago, but that main card, full of great fights. We have a big-time lightweight one between Islam Makhachev and Dan Hooker. You have a title fight, an interim title fight at bantamweight between the champ, or is he, Piotr Jan, Mr. Illegal Knee, taking on Corey Sandhagen, who's coming off a loss. And then in the main event, Jan Blachowicz taking on Glover Teixeira. Matt, so many good fights and so hard to choose out of the 15 as our two possible fight of the night contenders. But let's throw it on over to that screen, as always, presented by Manscaped. Head on over to their website, manscaped.com. Use the promo code FNP. You're going to get 20% off and free shipping. Let's throw it on over to the fight of the night screen. So when we're talking about a possible fight of the night, there's so many good ones to choose from on here. And as soon as I saw this one announced, it was just like when Fazeev and Riddell, well, a former common opponent of one of these guys, but when this one was announced, ooh boy, you know, finger on the pulse, you got to get ready for it. Demir Ismagulov taking on Magomed Mustafayev, two of my guys. For Mustafayev, he's been in the UFC for a really, really long time. Like, he has a loss at 155 to Kevin Lee. And I mean, hey, there's no shame in that. That was future title challenger Kevin Lee. Still could be. Still could be. And for Demir Ismagulov, he hasn't lost a fight since 2015. And that makes it, oh yeah, like, it's 18 straight wins for him. So it's absolutely insane. I love this one.
It always seems like we have different levels of, oh, you were a champion outside the UFC. And sometimes we get really, really excited.
Both of them.
Exactly. And sometimes we get really excited for those champions coming over because we realize, like, the body of work is impressive. And you can kind of tell based on who the UFC is initially trying to matchmake them with. That's what I'm really excited about this fight. Neither one of these guys are slouches at all, and on a card like this, it's going to give them both a massive opportunity to really get a lot more fanfare, because whoever does win between Mustafayev and Ismagulov is going to be deserving of one of those top-level opponents, and hopefully with them fighting on such a big card, it will get them what they deserve.
Cody Ons taking on Corey Sandhagen, and do I agree with the fight? Well, the fact that it's made? Yeah, sure. The fact that there's a belt attached to it? Maybe. Is it tongue-in-cheek that that's a picture we use for Cody Ons? Maybe a little bit, but Matt, I think Sandhagen beat Dillashaw by the narrowest of margins. You could argue with me, and that's fine. Maybe Dillashaw won, maybe Sandhagen won. At the end of the day, it's an L on his record. But now he gets a giant opportunity off of a Dillashaw injury for Petr Yan with his former foe Aljamain Sterling sidelined, but still training with everybody and their dog at the PI. This is an interesting fight, and I think on paper, this is an absolute banger. You've seen the buzzsaw that's been Corey Sandhagen against the Marlon Moraes of the world, and so on and so forth. And for Petr Yan, well, he's only lost to who? Magomed Magomedov, and then he got that one back, and then the Aljamain Sterling fight. So I absolutely love this one.
I don't know how this fight can be boring. I know we say that sometimes and then the fight ends up being boring, but the good news is that Petr Yan not only has great stand-up, great power, he fights with an absurd level of output and volume. What does Corey Sandhagen also do? Yes, he can knock you out with that one hit or quitter, but he also comes with a tremendous work rate, and that's why I think this fight's going to be phenomenal. Both guys are going to have to throw a lot of shots to get the other one out of there, and you know that both guys have the type of cardio that really lasts for a 5-round fight. I really think our co-main event's going to be that fight that we're not only talking about at the end of the night, but all throughout next week and the week after, because I know both guys are coming off a loss. It's a weird title fight, like you had mentioned, but I don't see a lot of people who are arguing like, oh, Corey Sandhagen shouldn't have this opportunity, and same thing with Petr Yan. Like, this is still a very entertaining fight, no matter who you are or what the implications are in the division.
Absolutely love it, and a little bit of an appetizer for later. Both these guys with very interesting training camps getting ready for this one. I can't wait for two possible fight of the nights. Let us know down below in the comments section what you think of these choices and who you've got as winning one of those bonuses. You should definitely check out our sponsor for this segment. It's Manscaped. Check them out, manscaped.com. Use promo code FMP. You're going to get 20% off and free shipping on your order today. I'll talk about my balls and my nose hair later on in the show. We have a stacked card coming up. So in total, we had three straight Fight Night cards that were 2 out of 5 star on Fight Matrix. We had the last one, Costa Vittori. That was rated a 3 out of 5 on paper before we went into it. This one this weekend's a 4 out of 5. And next one, 4.5 out of 5. It's absolutely fire for the next 2 weeks.
Is Simon Cowell judging these cards? Because these are 5 out of 5 cards. I don't care who you are. For me, they're definitely a 5 out of 5 card, because this is what I really enjoy about the next two cards. They are not only very top heavy, there's genuine depth to them, and that's why they're going to be exciting from the first prelim all the way up to the main event. That's why I'm giving it a 5 out of 5 on my card.
Matt's giving it a 5 out of 5. I think it's an awesome one too, and if we go through it, we've got rookie reviews for Tagir Ulanbekov making a second time out, taking on Alan Nascimento. We also have one for Andre Petrosky, who's probably in the biggest head scratch of a fight on this card, against 3-2 Hu Yaozhang, who showed up fit and ready for his debut at middleweight against Alan Amadovsky. That got scratched on the day of, then it got scratched again, so now he gets this shot against the Ultimate Fighter alum. I almost said Dana White's Contender Series. It feels weird to say Ultimate Fighter. We also have a second coming of Shamil Gamzatov. He's going to be taking on a really tough out Michael Olszewczuk, a guy who, if you look at his Wikipedia page, the picture they chose for him looks like a Rorschach test. Rorschach? I can't pronounce it. All I do know is fighters' names and as much as I can about them. I can't wait for this card. And listen, if you can't get enough of Fight Night Picks, check out our second channel, 15-minute card breaks. I will have time to get another video out for the channel. If you like some of the merch that the boys are sporting, you can check that out at fightnightpicks.com. If you want to find the full card betting guides, the podcasts, all the neat stuff that's over there, fightnightpicks.com, link down below in the description. Matt, I know you're fired up. Oh, I'm fired up for this card. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. And welcome to the UFC, to Brazil's Alan Nascimento. And Matt, for Nascimento, big time opportunity taking on a guy who, listen, it's almost like a welcome back to the UFC for Tagir Ulanbekov out of Russia, a Khabib Nurmagomedov adjacent cousin. He's somebody that's really been in that camp, really been entrenched in that corner. You're going to see a lot of pictures of him over on the Instagrams with the likes of Zubair Tukugov, who's also on this card, as well as Islam Makhachev up near the top. But Matt, Both of these guys, very, very interesting fighters. And I really kind of take pause, and I don't really want to say necessarily prospects, because it's kind of funny. Ulanbekov, actually the older fighter than Nascimento, who has more experience coming into the UFC. And both of these guys, over 30. Both guys, I mean, Ulanbekov with the least amount of fights, but 13. At this point in time, these guys, I don't know if you can still say prospect. I mean, one of them, Ulanbekov, a ranked fighter at number 15 in this flyweight division. But I really want to start off talking about Brazil's Nascimento, a guy who I look at him and I go, he's in the UFC? Really? Like, really? And I don't say that as any amount of disrespect. It's just an odd path to get to where we're at right now. Because for Nascimento, you look at it, his second to last fight is a loss. And you might say, oh, okay, well, hey, why? Who was it against? It was against Haulian Paiva. But he's been in the UFC for a long time. You would be right. For Haulian Paiva, that fight was on Dana White's Contender Series Brazil. And I have to say, if you go to UFC.tv, UFC Fight Pass, it's really hard to find those Contender Series Brazil fights. You really, and you got to type in the right keywords to find them. They don't just make it very easy. But in that fight, very back and forth, it was Nascimento who ultimately used a little bit of his wrestling with some of his striking. And to me, it was a split decision loss for Nascimento. I thought he won round one and round two because he mixed in his takedowns with his striking, and that's what won it. In the third round, Paiva was able to stuff them. He was able to use his striking. But regardless, Nascimento loses that fight. But it's not like that was yesterday. I mean, again, Paiva's been in the UFC for a long time. He's been linked to a fight with Sean O'Malley, for goodness sakes. So you look at it, well, how long did Nascimento stay out? Okay, so that fight was 3 years and 2 months ago. His last fight was 2 months ago when he took on 5-2 Elivaldo Lima, and he beat him by submission, and it was a very nice win. And you can tell Nascimento is one of those guys that probably could have been in the UFC a longer time ago. You look at the pedigree of the guys that he's fought, they're very good. He also trains out of Shoot the Box Diego Lima with some of the best in the world. You're going to see the Alain Patrick's in his corner. Obviously, Charles Oliveira trains there. Laureano Staropoli, who lost last weekend. There are a lot of good fighters, either than guys that lose and duck fights. But the whole crux of what I have to say, Matt, is that Nascimento actually has a Muay Thai background, but he doesn't necessarily fight like a Muay Thai fighter.
He doesn't. No, he is somebody who will mix in his kicks quite a bit, and you can tell that he does have somewhat of a Thai background, and really the kicks are the thing that's sort of given away. Now, the thing about Nascimento that is odd is he goes to the leg a lot with the kicks, he goes to the body with the kicks. He's not a big, like, I'm light on my feet, sort of bouncing up and down kind of a fighter. He does have more of that, like, I plot forward type of a style, which is sort of unique, because every time I do think of, like, a traditional Muay Thai fighter, I normally think of that, like, light on my feet, I sort of accept footwork over just pure offense. But when I watch Nascimento, he does have more of, I don't want to say a boxing heavy style, because he does throw quite a bit of kicks, but just sort of his forward pressure and overall kind of body language, if you will, he does fight sort of with the style of a boxer. And this could be a really interesting fight, because I'm going to be honest, I don't have the best read on Ulanbekov, because I feel like all of his skills are at a really good spot. He has a good foundation for a lot of his skills. It's just a matter of him sort of refining all of those skills and refining all of the things that he has at a base level right now. Because if Ulanbekov can take his wrestling and his scrambles and make them like half a point better, and then do the same thing with his wrestling, like, I think the same thing with his striking, I think even if he could just get some of those, like, half-level ups across his game, we'd be dealing with a fighter who would not only just be, like, a borderline top 15 guy, he'd be a top 10, and really just a more active guy, too. But that's a big thing with Ulanbekov. It feels like a lot of his skill set is very green right now, and a lot of it is sort of being refined as we're watching him. He's sort of learning on the job.
Well, let's see what we had to say about Ulanbekov getting ready for his UFC debut against Bruno Silva a long time ago. He's been out for what? It's been just over a year, his last fight, since he took on Silva, won a unanimous decision. We'll throw it on back to a 15-minute card brace. Rookie review for Tigir Ulanbekov. Taking on the former Fight Night Global Flyweight Champion, Tigir Ulanbekov. And Matt, I know a lot of people really excited for this debut out of the Russian fighter, Tigir Ulanbekov. I mean, this is a main training partner of Khabib Nurmagomedov, coming at you from Eagles MMA in Dagestan. We've seen Khabib in his corner before. We've seen Islam Makhachev and crew. And what can we tell you about him? I mean, man, very, very long, rangy striker, especially for 125 pounds. I'd like to see these guys face off. Can't wait for that this week. We've also seen an excellent ground game from him. Some really high pressure as well. If he has to push things up against the cage, he can do so. If he has to get a trip takedown, he will. And once he's on top, in guard, it could be from anywhere, but even from full guard, he can definitely do some slippery things. So a guy to really look forward to at 25, a long-awaited UFC debut from Tagir Ulanbekov.
Ulanbekov has... Peter Yan's kind of the guy who I always think of when I think of this. He's got sprawl-ready hips. Like, the second you make any kind of motion towards him, his hips can just kind of flex right down to the ground. So if you do go for any kind of lazy double leg, any lazy single leg, any lazy takedown or entries, he can basically just whip your head down to the ground, prime Hector Lombard style somewhat. Not with that kind of force, but still, like, he will sprawl you down. And the grappling from Ulanbekov, like we mentioned, he's really good at floating on top, too. Charles Oliveira, another guy who that kind of reminds me of, where he's never really stuck in a stagnant position. It's not like he's in half guard and then he moves to side control and he tries to advance to mount. It's all kind of fluid from him on top. So if he is able to get on top of Bruno Silva, I think it's going to cause him a lot of trouble.
And it's very interesting because if you look at it for Tagir Ulanbekov winning that belt against Vartan Asatryan, he looked great in that fight. His striking was on point. Like I said, I mean, his opponent, big cut by the eye and so on and so forth until he earned that belt. Then there was a lot of time off, about a year, and he took on a very familiar name, especially from the Fight Nights global scene, but from the Kazakh MMA scene, as well as the UFC now, and Zhalgaz Shumagulov, who had a pretty decent fight against Haulian Paiva in his debut. Some people thought maybe he won that fight.
Paiva's pretty good.
Ulanbekov loses that one majority decision. So what does he do? He comes back and rings off three big wins in 2019 with Gorilla FC. Wins the first one by decision, the other two by submission. Rides it out, takes some time off. I know he spent some time in the States training ahead of this one. If you look at the old Instagrams ahead of his UFC debut with Silva, he's got a little bit of Umar Nurmagomedov in there that you might recognize from signing to the UFC. And Usman Nurmagomedov, who just signed with Bellator, the undefeated prospect. So some interesting stuff there. But again, some of Dagestan's finest fighters and some of the lower weight classes from 55 down, really putting things together.
So if we go back and we look at that debut against Bruno Silva, I have to be completely honest. I was really underwhelmed. I mean, you were sold a bill of goods on Ulanbekov. He was a decent favorite in that fight. And listen, Bruno Silva had a bit of a rocky road his first three fights in the UFC, and now he looks like a phoenix rising. He'd probably knock anybody out at 125 or 135. But in that fight, MMA decisions for the numbers and the particulars, you had 130-27 Ulanbekov, you had 129-28, 12-29-28 Ulanbekov, and 229-28 Silva's. I thought it was a really close fight. The craziest part about it was the official judges for that one. Michael Bell scored round 1 and 2 for Ulanbekov. Victor Wolf scored round 2 and round 3 for Ulanbekov. So one judge gave round 1 to Silva. Another judge gave round 3 to Silva. So you can make a really good argument that, again, that fight was incredibly close. And it was. So for me, when I look at Ulanbekov, if this fight is strictly a Muay Thai or a kickboxing fight, he could have a very hard time against Alan Nascimento because Ulanbekov can struggle in some of those in-between positions. When he gets it to the mat, he's flowing. He's in his bread and butter state. He's eating, it's like grandma's brown baked bread. That's what it is when we're talking brown and butter. This guy is absolutely great there. And he trains with some of the best people in the world. But training with the best people in the world, I mean, listen, it either makes diamonds or it makes rocks. And you don't want just your average everyday rock, but sometimes they end up in the UFC too.
I think 9 times out of 10, though, it makes someone into a diamond. Like, I would much rather Ulanbekov be training with this roster of fighters than just a bunch of random people I've never heard of.
What about Marcos Mariano?
Listen, it doesn't work for everybody, but for one Jacob Malkoon, there's also a Robert Whittaker out there, too. I don't think Ulanbekov is just the training partner of a lot of great fighters. I do think that he contributes his own sort of unique skill set in there, too. It's just my big problem with predicting any Ulanbekov fight is just look at flyweight right now. There's a bit of a resurgence. I know it's not like there's 50 fighters on the roster and the top 15 is super competitive, but there's a big influx of new talent in this division. It does feel like one or two big wins, not that it's like women's flyweight where if you get one big win you can find yourself in a title shot, but one or two big wins can make you from unranked prospect to like a borderline contender in this division. So I do think that if Ulanbekov can just go out there and start putting together impressive performances, not just wins, because I do really like what you said about his win over Bruno Silva. It's one of those wins where yes, it's a win,
It's green on Tapology, but when you really break it down and start looking more into it, listen, I thought Ulambekov won that fight, but it was a lot closer than it probably should have been, and for those reasons, I do have some concerns in this matchup, but I do still like the overall game of Ulambekov. I don't think he's going to get stuck on the feet with Nascimento. I do think he'll be able to at least mix in the takedown a little bit early on in the fight, and if he can make Nascimento work early, I do think it'll at least ease up the work rate as it gets into the third round.
When I look at this one, this is the problem that I have. Ulambekov, very good on the ground. Nascimento, a guy who he fought 3 years ago and he lost on Contender Series. And again, it was a very close fight. He lost by split decision. If you look at it for some of the losses that he has on his record, he lost to Luki Matoya over with Ryzen. Well, that's fine. He lost to Ramos, who's on this card as well. So, I mean, listen, it is a good pedigree that way. Now, they're losses, but they're against good competition. And when you're a guy that has over 20 pro fights coming into the UFC, That's what I like to see. But I do have to give it pause. The long time off, the loss on the same episode that Maria Oliveira lost on. Now that's where I'm going with it. Because Oliveira was somebody where I went, what, you're in the UFC? Are you serious? Like, and yeah, Tabitha Ricci had a hard time taking her down last weekend in certain spots. But then when she got it to the ground, it wasn't even close. In this fight, it's like, okay, well, you couldn't beat Paiva. And then you beat somebody that was 5-2 in the regional scene who had a very, very bad level competition. It just, that's where I have some issues with this one. When I look at the odds for it, Ulambekov opened the favorite minus 300. He's minus 334 right now. For Nascimento, open a plus 250. He's plus 260. The Tapology votes, a surprise to us as they are to you. Matt, I'm going to hazard a guess. You're over under here. 90% Ulambekov. What are you saying?
I was thinking 70 Ulambekov, so I'm going to say under.
Yeah, 95% of 693 total votes for Ulambekov, 85% by decision. For the 5% that have Nascimento, 61% by decision. And when I was really kind of looking over this one, for Nascimento, again, he's 5'9 at 125. That's absolutely insane. We're getting into like Jerome Rivera territory, like Ode Osborne type territory in this division. The other couple of notes that I had, again, he's been in Muay Thai since he was 15. His only losses, five of them, they're all by decision, so it is tricky. For him, the way that he wins, though, he has 11 first-round finishes and 13 submission wins, so the guy's slippery on the ground. I just don't know if that translates against a guy like Ulambekov.
It's so hard to submit somebody off your back in the UFC, and that's really the only opportunity I see Nascimento having. Now, don't get me wrong, he could clip Ulambekov, hurt him, find his way to the back, but you get the idea. I don't think he can go out there and just wrestle for wrestling's sake with Ulambekov. So other than dropping him or hurting him on the feet, I just don't see how Nascimento gets to gear on the mat. So that's why I like Ulambekov in this matchup.
Yeah, I mean, recency bias as it is, I think Daniel Da Silva Lacerda is going to have a good career in the UFC. I mean, you like to see the pictures that he had with Jeff Molina after their fight. But when I look at Nascimento, all of his successes and all of the things that he's good at, I see them being nullified by Ulambekov, just like Da Silva when he took on Molina. So for me, I'm going with Russia's Tagir Ulambekov in this fight. Matt, we already mentioned two of his training partners who have big fights coming up. We have Tukugov, we have Makachev in the co-main event, Piotr Jan taking on Corey Sandhagen in the main. Jan Blachowicz looking to defend his belt, taking on old man time. Glover Teixeira, can't wait for it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. If you have a weird calendar, which I don't expect you to have, but if you do, and you write down every time I say this, I mean, listen, there's some fights that you should get excited about. Write this one on your calendar. We have Kazakhstan's Demir Ismagulov taking on Russia's Magomed Mustafayev. This is hands down my favorite fight on this weekend's card, and it's buried on the prelims. Right now, it's tentatively slated for our second fight on there. This one at lightweight between a couple of champions from different organizations. For Ismagulov, the former M1 Global lightweight champion, took on a great level of competition over there. Comes into the UFC, absolute buzzsaw. Best part about his career, he hasn't lost since 2015. He's on an 18-fight win streak. Almost ended in his last fight, got pieced up in the third round against Rafael Alves, and we'll talk about that a little bit later on. But for Ismagulov, this guy, to me, I look at him, and this might be a little bit of a stretch, but he's kind of like a Mike Trout. He's kind of like a, I don't know, Shohei Ohtani, they're on the same team.
10-war center field.
This is where I'm going with it, a 5-tool player. When I look at Demir Ismagulov, what doesn't he do well? In his last fight, that was the only spot where I could go, oh, okay, well, in the third round, he did slow down a bit. And I will say this. 2 years ago, he beat Thiago Moises by decision. That was impressive. Then 4 months ago, he took on Alves, and he beat him by decision. a long layoff between those fights, and I will admit, I didn't like the way that he looked in that third round. However, the pace that he put on in that fight was absolutely insane, and I'm not a big numbers guy anymore with MMA because you got to pick and choose, but these numbers, I had to write them down, and I really wanted to reference them because in that fight, he went 141 to 36 in terms of the total strikes. Significant strikes, only 56 of the 141 were significant. But with Demir Ismagulov, what I absolutely love, like I liked Jun Young Park last week until he decided, you know what, we're going balls to the wall. Let's get into a firefight with Gregory Rodriguez.
It was fun to watch.
Was fun to watch. But both of those guys, when they are on, Ismagulov and Park, they're good in almost every area. Ismagulov has better takedown defense. We know this, but pumping that jab out there. Stiff and steady, not giving his opponents time to figure out his range. He throws a lot of nice low calf kicks, and when he needs to, the perfect takedown attempts, especially when his opponents make mistakes. Demir Ismagulov, you don't win 18 fights by mistake at this level.
No, you're 100% right. And it's odd that I think timing is going to be one of the most important things in this matchup for both guys respectively, because I think wrestling is going to be really important in this fight, even though I can fully admit we might not see any takedown attempts from either one of these guys, at least early in the fight, because this is what has to be said for both these men. Magomed Mustafayev could go in there and double leg or single leg, I'd say 98% of the UFC's lightweight roster, and probably be able to complete a takedown against them. And I would say Demir Ismagulov, I'll take it down from like 98%. We'll go to like 95%. I still think he's a great wrestler, but you know what I mean? I don't think he's like the creme de la creme when it comes to wrestling in this division. But what I like about both guys is what you had mentioned. They have the ability to do everything. Yes, we are somewhat specialists, but there's more to our games than just the wrestling, just the striking. It's going to be a really interesting fight because personally, I feel like Ismagulov is able to mix his martial arts slightly better than Mustafayev. Although I will admit, I feel like Mustafayev for wrestling's sake might be a little bit better. For power's sake on the feet might be a little bit better. I just feel personally, Ismagulov is the slightly superior fighter at just mixing everything together. And that's why I think this fight's going to be so much fun.
The craziest part about this one, for Mustafayev, you look at the lineage and you want to go from his UFC intro on. He cut his UFC debut 6 years ago. He beat Pyotr Hallman by knockout. He beat Joe Proctor almost 6 years ago by knockout. Then he had a layoff. That one was about a year. He lost to Kevin Lee by submission. Then he took a long time off, fought Fiziev and knocked him out. That doesn't happen.
That body kick.
That doesn't happen. Then he took some more time off and he fought Brad Riddell and lost a split decision. That was a little over a year and a half ago. And the craziest part about that one is, did he really lose it? Because if you look at it, Riddell definitely beat him in the striking, but Mustafayev definitely won in terms of his wrestling. He went, and I wanted to get this one because I wrote these things down. He went 8 of 11 in takedown attempts, but he got outstruck 60 to 36 in terms of the total strikes. So again, he could have won round one or round two. Riddell won the third round. And then you look at the judges' scorecards. I mean, a little bit all over the place. There were 4 29-28s for Mustafayev. There was 2 29-29s. There was 3 29-28s for Riddell. And then 2 over on MMA decisions out of 30-27 Riddell. All of this to say, Mustafayev knocked out Fiziev and fought a very competitive fight against Brad Riddell. And for Ismagulov, he's kind of in the same trap. He hasn't been very active since he's been with the UFC, and it's been against lower competition too. I mean, Alex Georgis hasn't fought in the UFC since. Joel Alvarez,
he's pretty good.
We think highly of him. Thiago Moises is great, and Alves is a blown up featherweight, but really should compete at lightweight.
That's something. Other than Alves, I don't feel like Demir has had that poor of a level of competition since coming to the UFC. Like, Thiago Moises just headlined a show against Islam Makhachev not that long ago.
It's just, they're so spaced out. No, that's the trouble.
You're 100% right. It's just, this is going to be an interesting fight. And it's unfortunate that neither one of these guys are going to get into the rankings with a win. Because, you know, Mustafayev and Ismagulov are two of those names that ranked lightweights don't want to fight them. Guys with names don't want to fight either one of these guys. And that's why they're being forced to fight each other right now. This is the interesting thing about Mustafayev, about his last two opponents too. Because, of course, people know Fiziev, Riddell. They both were striking coaches at Tiger Muay Thai. They're now fighting each other. He fought them both completely differently. Like, he fought Brad Riddell like he was a 7-time All-American wrestler, and he actually struck with Fiziev. It was really interesting to see, and that's why I do say, like, with Mustafayev, he has all the abilities. It's just a matter of finally putting them all together, because I do think if Mustafayev gets on one of those, like, Gilbert Burns runs, if you will. Remember when Gilbert Burns was like, hey, I've got the jiu-jitsu, now I have the striking, then he put the two together. I think if Mustafayev can finally reach that point where he is comfortable with his own takedown attempts, with feigning his strikes into his wrestling, I do think that's when we will finally see him break into the rankings, because I do think he has a talent that is one of those, like, contender type of a talent.
Yeah, Mustafayev has a background in pancration. You go and you watch it, and I've watched this fight over and over again, because for Abubakar Nurmagomedov to fight Jared Gooden, I had to watch this fight. And when Mustafayev fought Nurmagomedov, it was at 170 pounds, and listen, it's all Mustafayev in that fight. He earns a doctor's stoppage in the first round. He wins the Sochi Star Cup of 2014. Sochi, Russia, never forget. Team Canada, another gold medal in hockey. But Matt, I really do like this fight. I mean, again, is it going to be the wrestling of Mustafayev, or does he show up like Muslim Salikov and throw every spinning attack that he has in his arsenal? I don't know. It's the weirdness, the grayness and the weirdness of Mustafayev to, I get what I get with Izmagulov again and again. He's like an old farmer. He wakes up at 4 with the crack of dawn, and by 6 o'clock he's in bed getting ready for the next day, and you know exactly to a T what he's going to do. And I'd be surprised if he throws anything crazy into that routine, but I absolutely love it. He hasn't lost in his last 18 fights. When you look at the odds for this one, Matt, I wrote them down before we started talking because, listen, we don't let them influence the pick. The pick's the pick. We already made our picks. We write these down so you know at least what they're at the start of the week. Izmagulov open a minus 300 favorite. He's a minus 269 right now. Mustafayev open a plus 250. He's a plus 214 underdog. And then the Tapology picks. We leave those a surprise as well. Not close at all. 681 total votes. 90% Izmagulov. 87% by decision. For the 10% that I'm Mustafayev, 40% by decision. 48% by knockout. Matt, all of that surprises me a lot.
Yeah, it is really surprising that Izmagulov is such a heavy favorite, at least by fans' consensus. But this is what I will say about Mustafayev. I thought he lost to Brad Riddell. I will say that right now. It was a really, really close fight. But that was a great example of when they were on the feet, Mustafayev struggled with the power of Riddell. When Riddell was able to land his big power shots, there was a big effect on Mustafayev. And on the flip side, when Mustafayev was getting his takedowns, he wasn't doing a lot with them on Brad Riddell. Now, yes, he was able to secure them, but he was leaving a little bit to be desired, because personally, I thought that once Mustafayev got Riddell on the mat, it was going to be one of those, like, oh, I pass your guard pretty quick, I get into side control. I really thought he was going to have a lot more success on the mat after it hit there, and that's why I'm a little bit hesitant to pick Mustafayev in this matchup with Izmagulov. I do feel like Demir is at least the more mobile fighter, and I think that if he can sort of do the Goldilocks, not put the foot too hard on the pedal like he did in his last fight, if he can fight a more intelligent fight like he did against Moises, I think he'll be able to get the win. Although, listen, this is one of those fights where the odds might have Izmagulov as a very big favorite, but personally, I do see this very much down the middle.
That's why I have to go with Mustafayev. The thing that scares me with my pick, though, is Izmagulov's one of those guys that banks time with his volume, and when you do that in the eyes of the judges, that's how you score, that's how you win a fight. When you're throwing that much volume like he did in his last fight, where every three strikes are great, every three in terms of your total, one of those three is a significant strike, and what's a significant strike and what's not? It's very difficult to know what lands and what doesn't, who actually calls a strike, because if it goes through the guard, it should be good, but sometimes you hit an arm and they call it a strike. It is what it is. But when you do look at the overall package of what Izmagulov brings in, like I said, he's a five-tool player, but then every now and again, you get a guy like, who do I have? Chris Davis. You get a guy, Chris Johnson. You get a guy like Chris Johnson that 1 year rushes for 2,000 yards and he just really surprises you. He comes out of the gate and has a good one. I think Magomed Mustafayev is this weekend's Chris Johnson. And he goes out there and he just rushes for it. He's going to be able to get it done. I like Mustafayev in terms of the in-betweens and the striking, in terms of the reads that he's going to make. And if it gets into a wrestling exchange, I like Izmagulov's wrestling a heck of a lot, and I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people go for the favorite in this one. I'm going to go for the decent underdog here in Mustafayev.
I think this is a phenomenal fight. Just for me, I think Izmagulov's a slightly more active guy. I think he's the faster one in this matchup, but yeah, this is going to be a really fun fight. And here's the great thing, too. Let's say Mustafayev gets his first takedown. I don't think it's as simple as he's just going to hold Izmagulov on the mat. We're going to get some fun scrambles in this fight. We're going to get a lot in this fight, and that's why we're so excited for it.
Absolutely. Can't wait for it. Matt going with Kazakhstan's Demir Izmagulov. I've got Magomed Mustafayev in this one. It's my favorite fight on the card. It's like Christmas in the day before Halloween. It's just a lot of fun. I'm going to listen to my ghost records. I'm going to have a great time. I can't wait for this card. We're going to have question mark kicks 2 hours before the prelims to lock in our final picks. You get the week done. You get to look at the weigh-ins. And then we're going to have our fight companion for the main card. Can't wait for it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Listen, it's the time of year where you stockpile candy because it was on sale at Walmart or Costco. It's also the time of year for a Frankenstein of a video because we have China's Hu Yaozhong. The nickname is Totoro, and I'm going to talk about that more as the video goes on. He's taking on Pennsylvania's own Andre Petrosky, and the reason why I say this is going to be a Frankenstein video is because this is a weird, weird fight that was Frankenstein together. Hu Yaozhong just got into a fight with Alan Amadovsky, but no, we can't have that one. So then they rebook it. Oh, no, well, that can't happen. So then finally he gets an opponent here in Petrosky who is willing, game, and able to take on a fighter that's 3-2 in your middleweight division. I can't wait for it, but what we're going to do in this one, we're going to throw it back to a 15-minute card breaks rookie review for Andre Petrosky, who just picked up his first UFC win not that long ago over a guy from Michigan in Michael Gilmore. Matt, let's throw it on back to the rookie review. If you look at it for Petrosky, this is squarely going to depend on his wrestling in this one. I mean, this is a guy that it's karate versus collegiate wrestling. The other crazy thing is the fact that how crazy is it that this was one of Team Ortega's guys? This was his second pick in Andre Petrosky versus, again, a guy that came as an alternate to replace Miles Hunsinger. If you look at it for Petrosky, this is a guy 7-1 as an amateur between 2016 and 2018. Between 2018 and now, 5-1. 3 wins by knockout, 2 by submission. Coming out of Henzo Gracie's in Philly. Yeah, Pat Sabatini also in this card from that gym. But Matt, Sabatini, Sean Brady, who was getting ready to fight Kevin Lee this weekend. Jonathan Webb, Jeremiah Wells, like so many great fighters. He was a guy that finished, 5th, 3rd, and 2nd at state in high school. So you like to see that out of his wrestling. Pennsylvania, obviously known for their wrestling in high school. He went to University of North Carolina. Then he went to Bloomsburg in Pennsylvania. Then I hope I don't mispronounce this one, but I think it's Kutztown. Is that it? K-U-T-Z town in D2 after that. But if you look at it, I mean, there was a great breakdown skill-wise by Ed Gallo. Everybody by now should know him. He did this piece over with Bloody Elbow. He's definitely a great follow on Twitter. You can follow him all over the place. But he mentioned that Petrosky does a really good job with his feints. And then he'll also use an overhand to kind of work to drop levels and then take like a single leg, take a knee pick, an ankle pick, like maybe not an ankle pick, but a knee pick or the single leg. He does a lot of things really well there. Then the other thing that I kind of saw in my tape study for this one, he does a really good job to strike the clinch. We see a lot of wrestlers that do that. Some guys don't have success. They get caught by straight shots. He did that against Aaron Jeffrey. He beat him in the first round. And listen, I'm Canadian. So what am I going to say about Aaron Jeffrey? Aaron Jeffrey's our guy. But Jeffrey just kind of outlasted him. I mean, he did a good job. He got out-wrestled and reversed in the second round of that one. Hammered out on top. He gets back up. And then eventually he ends up getting finished. But overall, Brian Ortega wanted to see more movement out of Andre Petrosky when he was standing. And I think that's one of those ones where it's the same thing. When he lost to Brian Battle in The Ultimate Fighter, he's like wrestling. And then he gets caught in a defensive submission. What was it? A head and arm choke? And he gets finished again. So it's one of those ones. If he had a little bit more flash and flair, then he might win more.
Exactly. Like Petrosky's worst nightmare is a guy like Gerald Meerschaert, because if he did move quite a bit more on the feet, then you would like him.
So you get an idea of Andre Petrosky's UFC debut, and basically he mopped poor Michael Gilmore at a Murcielago MMA, and it was a great performance. And the question mark that you're going to have for every single Petrosky fight is, can his gas tank hold up? Because in his losses, it doesn't, and he wrestles himself into exhaustion.
Well, I guess that's kind of my open-ended question for you. Do you think the last time out for Petrosky, we kind of got the best version of him possible? Okay, I do happen to agree with you on that, because if you go back and look at his Brian Battle fight on The Ultimate Fighter, listen, with Brian Battle, you know, we still don't really know where he fits into the whole thing, but we know he's a good fighter, he's a great grappler, he's a well-rounded fighter. He kind of set the blueprint on how to beat a guy like Petrosky. Gets him in that ninja choke, submits him, and just... With Petrosky, listen, I love the power, I love the physicality he brings into the cage. It's just sort of the in-betweens I worry about with him. I worry about the cardio, I worry about some of the submission defense, I worry about guys who can go out there, grind him to a halt, and just sort of put out the explosiveness of his strengths. I just don't think Hu Yaozhong's that guy.
I mean, when we looked at it, and again, the Amadovsky fight was supposed to happen a couple of times. We talked about Hu Yaozhong so much getting ready for that one. I want to throw it back to a review of that. I mean, we had so much to say about Hu Yaozhong. Let's throw it back there, and then we're going to talk about the pick, the odds on this one, and really get the full picture here. He's going to be taking on China's Hu Yaozhong, and his nickname is Totoro. Listen, I don't know if you watched the cartoon growing up, or the anime. I should say anime. If I offended anybody, I apologize. I actually quite enjoyed it. Watched it in my teenage years. It was pretty good, but... For Hu Yaozhong, this guy has one of the weirdest records, and he's overall one of the weirdest fighters to be in the UFC. And if you don't believe me, we don't have to look very much further than his record. He's 3-2 overall, lost his two fights in the UFC. Of his three fights that he won on the Chinese regional scene, and I have them here for you, the opponent's combined record was 2-4 at the time, and his last win was December 2nd of 2016. The weirdest part about it is the fact that on the regional scene, he fought at heavyweight. Well, then he comes into the UFC and he fights Cyril Asker. He weighed in at 232 pounds for that fight. He ends up losing by submission. That was Cyril Asker's last win in the UFC. He would go on to lose to one Tai Tuivasa that's also on this card. So then Hu Yaozhong decides, I'm going to move down to light heavyweight. Weighs in exactly on the nose at 205 pounds. Fights Rashad Coulter, who weighs in at 208 pounds. They have him knock him out, drag him out type of fight. It was very close. A few people gave it to Hu Yaozhong, but the majority gave it to Rashad Coulter. Coulter gets the win, but then he's no longer in the UFC. So Hu Yaozhong, his last fight was against Rashad Coulter. And I wrote it down here because the first fight was on the Bisping Gaslam card. To give you an idea, it was November of 2017. The next card was November of 2018. That was the last time we saw Hu Yaozhong in the octagon, almost 3 years ago. Now, the weirdest part about it is, he has that first fight at heavyweight. The second fight, he weighs in right on the middleweight limit. This fight is at middleweight. This is his first ever fight at middleweight. So I don't know if Hu Yaozhong is China's Jared Cannonier. Maybe the power is going to carry. If you go to the UFC site, they consider him a striker. If you watch him fight in his regional scene fights, which there's three wins, but the quality of opponent isn't great. He mixes in wrestling with his grappling, and he has decent striking, but his cardio wasn't very good. The one thing I want to say about him, Matt, before I hand it off, and it is a bit loaded, so bear with me a little bit. This is going to be your nugget. If you show up to a party on the weekend, if you're sitting at T-Mobile Arena, this is what you can tell your friends. So Hu Yaozhong's been 3 years away. He's been training with Li Jingliang and China Top Team. If you look over on his Instagram, there's nothing. Hu Yaozhong's not an Instagram guy. But if you go to China Top Team, you can see him drilling his wrestling. And he kind of looks a little cut up at 185. Like, physically, he does look really good. I know even in his debut, Dan Hardy and the crew were kind of saying, hey, he's a small heavyweight.
Yeah.
But this is where it gets really weird. So what I normally do if it's a fighter that I'm not overly sure of, or if it's a guy like Hu Yaozhong, I took the characters next to his name on Tapology. I threw them into Google. I translated it. I read an article from Sohu.com. Now, again, realize that this is translated, but I'm going to read directly from it. I'm going to pop it up on screen. He said, and this is a quote, again translated, I think the middleweight is more suitable for me regardless of size, strength, or other aspects will have some advantages, Hu Yaozhong told reporters about the reasons for the change. He emphasized that his recent preparations have been good, so on and so forth, but although the strength will definitely be smaller than the weight before weight loss, I don't have any discomfort now. He continues on to say, I've received his help from Li Jingliang. That's great. Then you scroll down a little bit more. Due to visa issues, Hu Yaozhong's coaching team will not be able to travel with him this time, and the date of the Chinese giant's entry to the United States has been postponed to July 6th, which means that 5 days before the game, the time difference is I have to overcome the problem as much as possible. The trip indeed is a bit rushed, but there is no way. I also want to go early. All of that scares me away from Hu Yaozhong because I haven't seen him in the cage in almost 3 years. His coaching team's not going to be there. He's been training with Li Jingliang, who might make the trip with him, but I don't know. And out of a translated article, it's really weird. So ideally, to me in my mind's eye, Andrei Petrosky blows the doors off of Hu Yaozhong in this one. But that's where it gets crazy because I mean, the picture that you see in front of you and the picture that you saw of Yao Zhang in the Amadovsky breakdown are two totally different guys, and that's the weirdest thing. I mean, he fought at 265 pounds in his debut, but again, he wasn't actually 265, he was in the 230s. He lost to Cyril Asker by submission. Well, then he goes out and fights Rashad Coulter, who missed weight at 205. Coulter wins, they kick him out of the UFC, and then Yao Zhang comes in and goes, well, yeah, I'm on my Jared Cannonier, let's try 185. And he looked amazing. He originally wouldn't have had his coaches with him if he fought in the States against Amadovsky because there was some visa complications, but that probably won't be an issue with him fighting in Abu Dhabi this week. So you get Hu Yao Zhang in Abu Dhabi with his coaches, with his training partner Li Jingliang from China Top Team. I mean, now we're talking like a perfect storm of Yao Zhang. It's just the fact that his last win was, and I want to make sure I get it right, 4 years and 10 months ago, and his last fight was 2 years and 10 months ago. That's a lot of inactivity to take on a guy who has a very questionable gas tank, but has been very active of late. And Hu Yao Zhang was billed as a striker by the UFC, but in his three wins was a wrestler, which is Andre Petrosky's bread and butter. He wrestled in the States in college.
Hu Yao Zhang's fighting an uphill battle this weekend. He really is. And it's sort of a shame because he came into the UFC too early. And it's not...
No, 3-0 fighters too... But Beast in 25-8 did it. He won the Ultimate Fighter.
And look what happened to him after that. He was
pretty good.
Good, but not great. He would always struggle against the next level. And that's like the best case scenario for a guy who came in really, really early in their career. Like, the perfect Hu Yao Zhang storm is like a category... It's like an afternoon rain. It's not a hurricane. And that's why I do think Petrosky's going to be able to win this fight. I don't think Hu Yao Zhang has the type of takedowns that can go out there and really put... Not Petrosky just on his back foot, but just make him tired. Like, get him up against the cage. I think if you are engaging in that type of wrestling with Petrosky, he's going to be able to dig the underhook, get your back up against the cage, reverse you, and then answer with power shots. It's not that Hu Yao Zhang doesn't have a game plan in this fight, because like you had mentioned, he has shown more wrestling than probably what the commentary would lead you to believe in his fights, but I just don't think he has any one skill that can go out there and really take this fight from Petrosky.
Ah, the one skill is he can outlast him. And for Petrosky, you look at the two losses, and I put an asterisk next to his 4-1 because he lost to Brian Battle, but it was on the Ultimate Fighter, so does it really count on your record? Sometimes they put them as such and sometimes they don't. But his other loss, Darren Jeffrey out of Canada, where same thing, wrestled himself into exhaustion, got caught in a bad spot and got finished. So for Petrosky, those cardio issues are always going to be there. He's a big muscled up guy. People don't like that tattoo that they can see right there. Listen, all I do know is that the odds for this one surprise me because they open at par, and Petrosky now is a minus 235 favorite, and Yao Zhang is around a plus 188 on best fight odds. Matt, Tapology predictions, we haven't looked at them. I'm going to say over under 85% Petrosky.
I'm thinking over.
All right, Matt. Ooh, 471 total votes, 93% Petrosky, 19% by decision, 20% by submission, 56% by knockout for the 7% that have Yao Zhang, 51% by decision, 40% by knockout. I have Petrosky in this one because, again, his greatest skill is Yao Zhang's greatest skill, and I think Petrosky's quite a better wrestler. Unless he wrestles himself into exhaustion, that's a giant disclaimer. If you feel really strongly on this one, that's my one big, kicker.
I just don't think Hu Yao Zhang has the takedown defense or just the ability to kind of outlast Petrosky and make this a battle of cardio. I understand that is his area to win this fight. I just think you have to defend a lot of takedowns to really get it to that point to begin with. Because let's say Petrosky is able to outstrike him on the feet, then I don't really think Petrosky's going to have to use a lot of his own offensive wrestling. And honestly, I think he can defend a lot of the takedown attempts from Hu Yao Zhang. So I do like Petrosky in this matchup. But this is going to be one of those weird fights for Andre. Because unless he looks great, no one's really going to care, I don't think. Because with Hu Yao Zhang, like you had mentioned, we have a heavyweight, then a light heavyweight, now a middleweight. He hasn't looked great at any step of the way. Like, at least with Jared Cannonier, he had a knockout at heavyweight, he had knockouts at light heavyweight. He had success as he moved down in weight, and there were positive signs with every drop in weight. With Hu Yao Zhang, we're still looking for that first really positive fight in the UFC. So maybe he can prove us wrong, but I do like Petrosky.
Can Hu Yao Zhang win his first fight in almost 5 years? We will find out. He's still a young guy. He's only, 26? So he's still got all kinds of time. But Matt, both of us going with Pennsylvania's own Andre Petrosky to win the fight. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have in this one and our big fights up at the top. Yan taking on Sandhagen for the belt, albeit interim, and in the main event, Jan Blachowicz taking on Glover Teixeira. Can't wait for it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it.
I
Take me down to the Scramble Fest City, where the weights won 45 and they're typically winning. Matt, this weekend we have Finland's Makwan Amirkani. Mr. Finland, he's taking on the Miracle, Lerone Murphy. And Matt, I absolutely love this fight because, listen, I have to say, Murphy came into the UFC and I scratched my head as to what kind of a fighter we were going to get. And you look at his record, he's 10-0 with a draw. And that one draw was against Zubair Takugov, who's on this card. And that fight was so much fun. It was very close. You can make an argument either way that either one of those guys won. But in the end, it's a very important fight for a guy to debut like that, have a fight like that, and then move forward. And I hate to really feed a fed horse because, again, their training partners, so on and so forth. But when you look at a ceiling of a guy that fights a fight like that, they can go on to do great things. We saw that from Armin Tsarukyan and Islam Makhachev. I know that Armin's a good fighter. And from that loss, I learned a lot from Murphy drawing against Takugov, a guy who, listen, he had a rocket ship strapped to his back. He was going to fight Artem Lobov, and we were going off to the moon, and it was going to be great. And that fight was going to take place in our home province of Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada. Hell, I even have the poster there in the corner. But all of this to say, I thought Murphy looked really good in that fight. He really surpassed my expectations because he didn't fight in any giant major organizations. He wasn't a Cage Warriors guy. He wasn't a KSW guy. He wasn't even a, I don't know, name your European promotion type of guy.
Bama?
So when I looked at Murphy, I just had a lot of question marks. He very well impressed me in that fight. So then he takes on Hamosh, who's on this card, and he finishes him. And then he fights Douglas Silva de Andrade. Now, De Silva fought Gaetano Perello not that long ago. And when that fight happened, Matt, my wife doesn't watch a lot of fights. She might be able to hear me right now from another room. All of this to say, I said, no, no, no. Sit down. You're going to want to watch this because Douglas Silva de Andrade is going to knock out Perello very, very fast. And what happened? Oh my God. He turned him into an ironing board. So for Murphy to have those giant wins and the way that he beat those guys, I think that it means a lot. I put a lot of stock into Lerone Murphy. I think he's a great fighter. For Makwan Amirkani, his UFC career started off like that too. He beat Andy Ogle with one of the craziest knockouts I've ever seen. And in his 5-on-in, it's not very sexy, like his picture is on Tapology. He's 2-3, but the wins are very important. He beats Chris Fishgold, performs to the night submission against an ADCC guy who was very adept on the ground. He beats Danny Henry by anaconda choke. That's a lot of fun. His losses, Shane Burgos by knockout. His loss to Edson Barboza was gross and not close, and that was a mismatch. But his last fight against Kamwela Kirk, listen, I'm going to pump my tires, and I don't mean it as such. I want to say that. I had Kirk to win in that fight. I think we were opposite of the picks. All of this to say, Kamwela Kirk was coming in with the deck stacked against him. He necessarily wasn't meant to win that fight, but man, Makwan Amirkani just kind of didn't show up.
Really, up until Makwan's last performance, yeah, there were some negatives along the way, but for the most part, it's like, okay, you lose to Shane Burgos, you lose to Edson Barboza, two of the best kind of worst strikers who defend takedowns in the division, so there's really no shame. And then going into that Kamwela Kirk fight, I just thought, hey, if you're not here, it doesn't mean that that means you're here. You know, there is an area in between, and I thought Amirkani could just settle in as one of those really fun fighters outside the top 15 who, listen, if you give him a favorable matchup, he might look really good, and if you gave him an unfavorable one, we all kind of know what his limitations are. I don't think we're seeing that fighter anymore, and that really is the unfortunate thing. Like, against Kamwela Kirk, you think, okay, if Makwan's going to have success, he's going to wrestle, he's going to use a lot of just activity, and he did! Until he didn't. And this has been my real big problem with Amirkani, and this has been throughout his entire UFC career. He's a guy who, every time he has success, it's not like he's following a yellow brick road to the city of Oz. He's following a yellow brick road into like a black hole. Because with Amirkani, all of his success eventually leads him towards failure. If he does go out there and just wrestles, which he kind of has to do to beat most guys at the UFC level, he ends up just getting really tired for it. And Makwan Amirkani is one of those guys who I immediately think of when it's like, okay, you either win by submission or finish really early on in the fight, or you're just out there being a punching bag for a solid 10 minutes. Because the thing you hate to see from Amirkani isn't just the fact that he accepts damage. He doesn't respond well to it whatsoever. If you start landing clean on Amirkani, it's not just a fact of, oh, he doesn't have good striking defense, or oh, he doesn't have a good chin and he goes down. If you land clean on him, it's almost like a question of heart. I don't think he's a guy like Justin Gaethje who you hit him clean and it's like, okay, now the fight has started.
With he's no Mason Jones.
No, With Amir Khan, even go back and look at the Shane Burgos fight, and listen, just because I'm saying this doesn't mean it's right, but I truly believe this. He didn't get knocked out by Shane Burgos as much as he just gave up against him. Go back and watch that second and third round. Yes, he's eating a lot of shots, but fatigue beat Amir Khan in that fight more than just Shane Burgos hammering on him. And yes, Shane Burgos is the reason you're getting tired. He's throwing boxing combinations to the body into the head, but what I'm trying to say is, it's not just the fact that you got TKO'd, it's the fact that I saw you give up in a fight. And with an MMA fighter, we've kind of seen, like, heart and toughness and cardio can take you really, really far. If you just look at Jan Blachowicz. Look at Michael Bisping. Like, Bisping might not do anything super flashy, especially in his prime, but he was really, really tough, never got tired, and could face adversity. Those are three things that I just don't think Makhwan Amir Khani is built for in the UFC. And when I look at Lerone Murphy, you're going to face adversity if you're fighting him. He can box. He can defend your takedowns. He's got great cardio. He's got heavy hands. And not just heavy hands, he has technical hands too. And I think when you have a skill set like that, you're kind of beat to beat somebody like Amir Khani. When the going gets tough, I don't think Makhwan Amir Khani looks to get tougher. I think he's looking for a way out.
Oh, boy.
I'm sorry, but when you look at Amir Khani, I feel like it's a lot of hype. Like, his UFC debut, he wins by flying knee in 6 seconds. He's in the post-fight press conference. It's like, wow, Makhwan, you're handsome, you're a model, and you can knock people out. What can't you do? And it's felt like ever since that moment, people have been kind of, you know, they've been in this big wave of Makhwan. I just don't think he's a top-ranked fighter. I think there's been a promise that, hey, if he can get everything together, and if he can round out his game, then maybe we are dealing with a ranked fighter. I just don't ever think we're going to see that evolution from him.
Well, the big change coming into his fight against Kirk that I noticed was over on the Instagrams, because Makhwan Amir Khani, not necessarily aligned with SBG, at least you don't see pictures of it. I've seen him training in Finland with, and I want to make sure I get it right, Loop Martial Arts, and I want to get the names right of some of his training partners and his coach. He's working with Marcus Raito Honka. He's working with Ali Santalatiti. I apologize. And then Henry Lintula. And listen, he's working with a lot of Finnish prospects, a lot of Finnish MMA fighters. But the biggest difference, and this is what I want to hammer on, not SBG anymore. We're out of the MA gym, which isn't, what does it stand for? It's Makhwan Amir Khani's gym, and that's great. I like the fact that he's coaching, he's giving back. I mean, Gerald Meerschaert coaches, and sometimes he beats Makhmud Muradov, and sometimes he loses to Khamzat Chimaev, but Amir Khani's not getting the rest of the training partners that he could or would if he's going to be fighting the top fighters in the world. So I do really worry about Amir Khani that way, losing to a guy like Kirk. Kirk's a lot lower on the you know, overall global scale compared to Lerone Murphy, and it's kind of Lerone's world in this fight. So again, odds for this one, Murphy open to minus 300, he's minus 340. Makhwan Amir Khani open to plus 250, he's plus 260. The odds are a little bit rich for my blood, but I like Murphy in the in-betweens in this one.
Well, that was what I was going to ask you. Are you surprised they matched up Murphy with Amir Khani, especially coming off both guys' last performance? Because to me, Murphy, it's not like he was ready for a ranked guy. Maybe they are trying to use Amir Khani's name to sort of build Murphy up. I felt like he had somewhat passed Amir Khani in the grand scheme of things.
Lerone Murphy was matched up with Charles Jourdain. The fight was supposed to happen last month, but there were some visa issues for Murphy. And if you look at it for Amir Khani, he was supposed to fight a couple of different guys. He was supposed to fight Kamwala Kirk, or he did fight Kirk. He was supposed to fight Nate Landwehr back then, and then coming into this one, he was originally supposed to take on Tristan Connolly, and then he gets Murphy. So yeah, you're going like Makhwan Amir Khani, Tristan Connolly, that would have made sense.
Exactly.
Makhwan Amir Khani, Lerone Murphy does not make sense. The topology votes for this one surprised us. They are to you, but no, they're not.
No.
643 total votes, 86% Murphy, 64% by decision, 30% by knockout. If you like Makhwan Amir Khani, let us know down below in the comments section. If you're from Finland, say hi. It's cold there like it is here, but in New Brunswick, we don't have 24 hours of darkness. So there's that. We're not in the Arctic Circle. I've got Lerone Murphy in this fight.
I think Lerone Murphy's going to have a number next to his name by this time next year. I guess that's a long time, but still, you get the idea. Like, featherweight is full of killers, and I think he fits right in with all those top fighters. I really like Murphy in this matchup, and hopefully this is the opportunity that we've been hoping for. It's really hard to get a name in the UFC and just sort of set yourself apart from the average unranked fighter, but hopefully Murphy can look really good against Amir Khani, who is more of a name than just your average unranked featherweight on this big card. Hopefully this is sort of the springboard that Murphy needs.
Murphy wins this fight, and then in the call out with all of his teammates and friends in attendance, he calls to beat Magomed Sharipov out of retirement.
I can't wait
for it. Both of us going with England's Lerone Murphy, the miracle to get the win. Big time fights coming up on this card that you're not going to want to miss, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say, let's get into it. Very interesting fight coming up this weekend at 205 pounds. We have Lord Michael Olashayshuk out of Poland taking on Russia's Shamil Gamzatov. And Matt, this is one of those fights where I really have to scratch my head trying to make a pick and prediction, because I can do the analysis, I think. I mean, knock on wood. But when I look at this one overall, both guys' strengths play into the other guy's weaknesses. And normally in a fight like this, I would take the wrestler and the grappler in terms of the exchanges and I would pick them to win. But that's not always true in certain fights. And in this one, if you look at it for Shamil Gamzatov and you take everything at face value and you write down your notes and you go, okay, and I will, let's do that. I go, okay, this is a guy that, listen, he's got a combat sambo background. He's been a champion in that. He's had a lot of successes in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. He has really nice kicks from long range. All of that sounds very good. And then you look at his debut, and yes, again, on paper, a very tough one against Clitson Abreu, a former champion in other organizations, and you beat him by split decision. And Clitson, listen, he had back and forth fights in the UFC. He's no longer with the company, but he's not that great of a guy. And for Gamzatov, he's undefeated, but he's one of those guys where I try and project a ceiling for him, and I just don't know where it is based off of inactivity. And I look at the wins in the 5-on-in for Shamil, and 5-on-in goes all the way back to World Series days. His fifth to last win was with World Series. He beat Teddy Holder. Then he beat Rodney Wallace with ACB 4.5 years ago. Then he beat Eddie Truck Gordon by decision 3 years and 3 months ago. Then he beat Rex Harris. Ooh. Is that the guy that posts all those things on Twitter? Who's that, Rex? Rex Chapman?
The guy who played for the Phoenix Suns?
Yeah, he just copies and pastes memes. I get annoyed by them. I think I have him muted. But Rex Harris, you win that. And then you fight Clitson Abreu 2 years ago. And for Shamil Gamzatov, he's been booked in fights since then. And that's kind of the weird thing. He's been booked in four. Two of them against Sylvain St. Preux. He withdraws. Then he has one against Devin Clark. He withdraws. And then earlier this year, he had one against Dawn Jung. He withdrew due to visa issues. So whatever it's been for Gamzatov, all I know is he doesn't fight all that often. He's billed as a very good ground fighter, but I haven't really seen it against good competition, especially all that often. And Matt, I know you have a lot of interesting things to say about his opponent, because for me, with the Rorschach test that is his Wikipedia picture and Michael Olashayshuk, the parts are there. We could build a 69 Camaro, but are we getting a 69 Camaro, or are we going to get like a Chevy Cavalier?
We might as well do this exercise with the fans, because we've done this right before we started filming. I can sell you two very different versions of Lord Michael right now, okay? Let's start with a positive version. Great heavy hands. I would say pretty good cardio for the size of him, good output. He's got a great chin, he can eat big shots, he goes to the body a lot, he's an okay defensive grappler. Trust me, there's holes in that. Now, I think that's a pretty good fighter for 205 pounds. Yes, it's not perfect, but now there's a very different version of Olashayshuk, where it's, you move forward, but do you really throw anything? Yeah, your hands are up, but is your striking defense that good? You can get offensive takedowns, but are you really good at defending takedowns from other good wrestlers? You see what I mean? Like, there's a lot of positives to talk about when we're talking about the game of Lord Michael, but there's just as many negatives too. So I guess I'll start on the positives right now. With Michael Olashayshuk, the first thing I always think about is the body shots with his punching combinations.
Look at old Jean Vallante, and just a great guy. Played football at Hofstra.
I know that me bringing up Jean Vallante isn't the best example of levels of competition, but still, if you just look at that performance, like, that was a really impressive way to get a guy like Vallante out of there. He's marching forward, has a very high stance with his hands. He's able to block and deflect all the shots that Vallante throws at him. One quick left hook to the body, Vallante is down. And that really does show you what the best version of Lord Michael is. He's just stalking you forwards, very high stance, and plodding forward quite a bit. Now, it can work to his detriment, because he is in that weird category where he doesn't really have his Hall of Fame stats in punching power or punching volume, so he can kind of get outmatched with both of those things, and that's what does worry me. I know we've gone back and forth a lot with his fight against Bukauskas, but the easiest way to set up that fight is Olashayshuk's the one moving forward, he's throwing the bigger shots between the two, yeah. But I would say that Bukauskas is landing the slightly more shots as he's moving backwards. Neither guy is landing these massive power shots. I would say Olashayshuk's able to land the few more damaging shots between the two, but the majority of that fight is him moving forward, eating shots, and Bukauskas moving backwards, eating shots. That's going to be really interesting in this fight, because If Gamzatov is the one on the back foot trying to strike with a guy like Oleshchyk, I think Oleshchyk gets him out of there in the first round. I really do. I think Oleshchyk's combination of body punches and head punches with his punching power is really going to give Gamzatov issue. The key for Gamzatov in this matchup, or at least I think it will be, is how's he going to time his takedown entries off of the actual striking combinations of Oleshchyk? Because if he's the one moving backwards, making Michael move forwards and let his hands go, I think Gamzatov could get in on his hips, find himself getting an offensive takedown pretty quick, and probably submitting Oleshchyk. Like, stranger things have happened because the defensive grappling of Oleshchyk is not very good whatsoever. He just doesn't really move a lot on his back.
Look at his two losses to Jimmy Crute and to OSP. Now, again, they're very good fighters on the ground, but like Avon Flew, they laugh about it. Oh, you should be able to get out of that. But no, you don't. Not when you're fighting OSP. And when you fight Jimmy Crute, you know he's going to take you down. And that just so happened to happen. So for Gamzatov, the building blocks are there, especially with a guy who stands with a high stance. If he does happen to do that, you know exactly what you need to do. It's just like Ricky Glenn and Grant Dawson. Grant Dawson, I'm just going to wrestle myself into exhaustion. And then in the third round, I got nothing left in the tank.
That's a great fight, though.
We'll see what happens this weekend. But again, I really do have a tough time on this one. I thought Bukauskas beat Oleshchyk, but again, at the start when I watched the fight, I thought Tanner Bozer beat Andrei Arlovsky. It's the same type of fight. One guy moving forward with bigger actions, another guy landing volume on the back foot. It really was tough to tell. I don't think we're going to get that in this fight because for Gamzatov, his striking's nowhere near even the level of volume and kickboxing-wise, not close to Bukauskas.
No, and the footwork's really the big difference between those two. Like, Bukauskas, yes, he didn't have very good run in the UFC.
Oh, he's not in the UFC anymore. Okay,
okay, Craig, let's not act like Bukauskas is some top 15 talent who just got cut by some, like, whim or something. Like, he lost a lot of fights in the UFC. Let's just call it what it is.
Lost a few.
He lost to Khalil Roundtree, who's not an amazing fighter. Is my point. Gamzatov doesn't have the just outside movement that Bukauskas does, and that's why I think he's going to end up eating a lot more of those power shots than Bukauskas ended up eating. Because with Bukauskas, he's able to move a lot more to his left and right. He's able to make the slightly better decisions on the back foot. With Shamil, I just don't think he's going to be able to have that kind of problem solving on the back foot. I think with him, it's either, okay, I'm moving backwards or I'm moving forwards trying to shoot my takedowns, and I think Oleshchyk can time just that simple of a game.
The odds for this one, Oleshchyk open underdog +130 is +135 right now. Gamzatov open to -150, -163 or thereabouts on best fight odds. Matt, we haven't looked at the Tapology votes. I'm going to guess Gamzatov 60% over under. What are you saying?
I think the underdogs should have more support on Tapology.
The underdog has less. 738 total votes, 79% Gamzatov, 77% by decision for the 21% that have Oleshchyk, 59% by decision, 32% by knockout. I open the video saying this, and sometimes I don't pick the fights based on that fact, but in this fight I will, because Michael Oleshchyk doesn't have great takedown defense. That's all Shamil Gamzatov has other than that and a leg kick that can set things up. And with a guy with a high guard like Oleshchyk, that's why I like Gamzatov in this fight. The inactivity scares me, because how's his gas tank going to react? But if you can beat a guy like Klitson Abreu in the areas where he's good at, you can beat a guy like Oleshchyk in the areas where he's bad at. And I think that wrestling and grappling acumen and the combat sambo background are going to help Gamzatov. But in terms of his ceiling for either one of these guys, I thought Oleshchyk could be a ranked light heavyweight, which isn't a crazy thing to say. There's only like 20 of them around right now.
15.
Gamzatov, I don't think either one of these guys are going to be ranked by this time next year.
No, I agree. I don't think Oleshchyk has a destiny in the rankings, and I was someone who thought he did. I can be very open with that. But I do just like this matchup stylistically. Unless Gamzatov is able to get that takedown early in this fight, I just think the overall work rate of Michael is going to give him an issue. And if he is able to go to the body early on in this fight and really invest in some of those techniques, I think defensively on the feet, he's going to be able to just cover up and react to anything Gamzatov throws at him. And as long as this fight is on the feet, I think Oleshchyk's got it in the bag.
100%. I absolutely love this fight. Matt's going with Poland's Lord Michael Oleshchyk. Please check out that Wikipedia picture. It's weird. I don't know who chose it. Probably Michael himself. Like, there might be an edit under that. I've got Shamil Gamzatov out of Russia. Can't wait for this fight. It should be a great one. Big one at the top of the marquee at 205. It is for the belt. Jan Blachowicz taking on Glover Teixeira. You're not going to want to miss this. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say, let's get into it. Like Kevin James, Joe Rogan, and even the Polish-Canadian Krzysztof Szczojczynski found out in 2012, here comes the boom. I absolutely love this fight. Coming up this weekend at we have a giant one at welterweight between Brazil's Eliseo Zaleski dos Santos. Capoeira is the nickname. The guy fights like an absolute insanity. He's taking on France's God of War, Benoit Saint-Denis. And Matt, I absolutely love this fight because for the UFC newcomer, he has a definite blueprint to win. And this is a guy that spent plenty of time, 5 years about, with the French Special Forces, the SAS. And the thing that I love out of all of the tape study, and it's fairly easy to find on Saint-Denis, is the fact that this guy's like farm strong. You know those guys?
Like Matt Hughes.
You grew up around them, or they went to your high school, and then they end up wrestlers, and holy smokes, like a guy like Jared Rosholt, but oh yeah, this guy can hold his own in the striking too. So there's so many different things to love out of Saint-Denis' game, but he's a guy that had a judo background from growing up. Then he goes into the military, he accentuates his jiu-jitsu, and then when he decides he wants to round things out and become a martial artist, he goes to the Venom Training Center, which I think there's one in Tokyo, there's one in France, and then there's also one in the States. And you see that just about every time out from Saint-Denis, but he's a guy that spent time with a few smaller promotions, but his last five fights with Brave in big opportunities. He's also a guy that spent time at welterweight, but also at super lightweight, and I low-key love how they bill it as that at 165. But the things that I love about his game are the fact that when this guy gets you down, you're in big trouble, and that starts as soon as the referee says go. And the reason why I say farm strong, Benoit gets the takedown. He finds a way to get it. He wraps his hands. He grabs a leg. He does whatever he wants. And then once he gets it to the mat, you're going to have a really hard time getting up. These things are all very good. The one thing that I don't like is his striking and his striking defense. It's not great. However, at 8-0 and at almost 26 years old, Benoit Saint-Denis is a guy that you're going to see in the UFC for a long time.
I agree 100%. He is a really exciting prospect, but this is the real key about this fight. This is a lot for his UFC debut. Eliseo Zaleski dos Santos is a fighter who at one point was that like borderline, oh, this week he's ranked number 15 and next week he's like 16, so he doesn't get that much shine. Like, he was one of those tweeners, if you will, between being a ranked and really exciting welterweight and just being one of those like fight of the night contenders who finds themselves outside of the rankings, sort of in that kind of Nico Price category, if you will. And it's been a really weird run for Zaleski dos Santos because the highs are very high, but the lows are very low, too. You have to remember, this is a guy who has a knockout win over Omari Akhmedov at welterweight. He has another win over another really good middleweight, too. You might have heard of him, Sean Strickland. Exactly. If you knock out guys who are middleweights, then you must have ridiculous power at this weight class. And that's what I think about when I think about Zaleski dos Santos. Nothing he does seems like it's done with a 100% force behind it. He just has a great way of moving on the feet, and it feels like everything he does is sort of momentum-based. Now, there's a lot of positives that come from that. Once he starts going downhill, kind of like Giannis, it's really hard to stop Dos Santos. But the issue that he has, and you kind of saw that in the Muslim Salikov fight, is that if he isn't able to get into that rhythm to begin with, you can kind of stifle his attack. He's a really unique fighter in that respect, because even go back and look at another fight where he had some trouble with, the Luigi Benjamini one. Early on in that fight, when you're not letting Zaleski get into his rhythm, you can have really good success against him. It's just, once he is able to get the boxing going with the kicks, he's a tough fighter to deal
with. And that's how Benoit Saint-Denis can win this fight. If he goes out there, boom, gets a takedown, you can submit Eliseo Zaleski dos Santos. Very easy for me to say that, but Luigi Vendramini was almost able to do it, and you've seen Luigi at 155 had the highest of highs and also the lowest of lows against Paddy Pimblett, Barstool's own. And if you look at it for Zaleski, you can make an argument that he won his last fight against Salikov. And listen, we definitely sold you a bill of good on that one.
I thought it was going to be great.
And we didn't deliver. It wasn't a very good fight. And that's the thing. Zaleski has to get into that rhythm, has to get his striking going. And for Benoit, he's got to get the takedowns going quick and early, because as the fight goes on, Saint-Denis will slow down and he starts. And this is the craziest thing that scares me in a fight against Zaleski. And this was a read that the commentary team last weekend, when you had the main event between Vittori and Costa, say Vittori's hands are starting to get low. He can eat one of those head kicks from Costa. Just so happens he can eat like 20, 25 of them. They're no big deal. He's got an iron chin. But I don't know how many Saint-Denis can take. I also don't know how many of the punches and accumulation of everything that he can take, because I saw him in a fight, and this is a bit of a stretch, that no contest that he has on his record, that was back 2 years ago against Pavel Kiliak. That was back with Brave, and that was his debut with Brave. In that fight, back and forth, so on and so forth, they go ahead, clash of heads. Benoit gets the takedown. And then it's a little bit of a back and forth. The round ends and he's got a giant gash and he bled all over the canvas. And the girl that's tending to him was like, no, this can't go on. The fight ends TKO due to a doctor stoppage, but afterwards it's no contest because of the cut. So that's why that one's there. But I really want to highlight the level of competition that he's faced, because in his last two fights against Luan Santiago, he wins by arm triangle. That was 6 months ago. That's a former Brave champion at lightweight. You've seen good fighters come in from Brave in the past. His last win against Arcaiz Ramos, or sorry, it's Ramos because he's out of Spain. For Ramos, that's a guy, former K1 champ in Spain. His total record in kickboxing was, and I wrote it down here somewhere, it was 23-3. He was an ace standing. Benoit was able to withstand any of the strikes, get it down to the mat, and submitted. And Ramos had never been submitted in his career either, and he was a pretty accomplished fighter. So for Benoit, the path is definitely there.
It is, but I feel like we're selling like the best version of Saint Denis right now. What I do worry about...
What the hell do you want me to sell?
Well, no, it's just there's like a realistic expectation. Right now, my big issue with Saint Denis, and I really want to get your opinion on this, it is odd because you mentioned the judoka background, how good he is at judo. He doesn't necessarily go for traditional judo types of takedowns, and I'm really glad that you mentioned it. He will just kind of go for anything, and that really worries me against a guy like Zaleski dos Santos. If Saint Denis was more of that, like, I get the underhook, which is just sort of a positional fighter yourself during the fight, and I'll sort of progress to my takedowns from there, I could actually probably sell you a really good way of how Saint Denis wins this fight, because we have seen Zaleski dos Santos not necessarily get out grappled, but just get out worked on the mat. That really has been the key. Look at what Vendramini was able to do to him. It's not just the fact that he took him down and had success there. He just kind of outworked dos Santos once it did hit the mat. I just don't think Saint Denis is going to have that level of activity once the fight does hit the mat. And I do think he's going to struggle with just getting that initial takedown attempt. I think if he gets it in that first round, yes, he'll have a ton of success. I think the footwork of Zaleski dos Santos is going to give him trouble, though, at least early on in this fight.
Zaleski has 52% takedown defense in the UFC. He struggled against smaller guys on short notice. These are all big red flags for me. So I look at the odds for this one. Zaleski opened a minus 225 favorite. He's around a minus 188 on best fight odds. For Saint Denis, he opened a plus 190. He's plus 161. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, I'd hazard a guess that the guy with UFC performance bonus written all over him, probably a big favorite in their eyes, and it's close. 496 total votes, 59% Zaleski, 62% by decision for the 41% that have Saint Denis, 41% by decision, 40% par soumission pour Eliseu Zaleski dos Santos. Matt, est-ce qu'on va avec le gars de France en Benoit Saint-Denis, or are we going with Zaleski dos Santos? I can't speak Portuguese.
Unless Zaleski dos Santos has completely fallen off a hill athletically.
At almost 35.
I do think he should be able to win this fight. Because yes, he's struggled with some smaller grapplers. You did kind of forget he beat Omari Akhmedov, who's a huge grappler, especially at this weight class. And he defended takedowns to do that, too. I know that was a while ago. Akhmedov is primarily a middleweight, but still, that's an impressive win to have on your record against a primary grappler. It really is. And I do think there's an area for Saint Denis to win. It's just for your UFC debut to be against a guy with a ton of top-level experience in this weight class, I think it's going to be too much too soon. But the exciting thing is that I think if Saint Denis has success in this fight, this is one of those fights where you can look back at win, lose, or draw and still say, hey, he at least built a foundation for success that he could have in the future. Because if Saint Denis goes out there, looks good for a round and a half, similar to Vendramini, for instance, but ends up losing, and I still think he can go on and have a really successful career after that. I do like what I've seen out of Saint Denis. I just think it's a little bit too much too soon.
When I look at Zaleski and you look at that fight against Akhmedov, he wins that one impressively, and then his next fight out, he gets taken down five or six times by Keita Nakamura. So it is a really, really tricky one. I like Zaleski because, again, I mentioned it was Saint Denis' striking defense. His hands start down by his side. That's not a great spot against a guy, a capoeira specialist in Zaleski dos Santos. So for me, I like Zaleski, but I've spent the majority of this video telling you that Benoit Saint Denis has a great opportunity in this one. And for those reasons, I want to hear from everybody down below in the comments section. We both have Zaleski, but this weekend, if Saint Denis got his first takedown attempt and gets a head and arm choke, I would not be surprised in the least. But Matt, I can't wait for this fight. This is going to be a really fun one.
It should be.
All right, we can't wait for it. Up at the top, two title fights, one for the interim strap at 135 between Jan and Sandhagen in the main event, 205 on the line. Old man Glover Teixeira taking on Jan Blachowicz. Can't wait for it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it.
I like to
It's an all-Russian affair. Coming up this weekend at middleweight, we have the former two-division and two-time champion over with ACB. It is Albert Duraev making his UFC debut, taking on Russia's Roman Kopylov. And Matt, I absolutely love this fight, and I got to get this out of the way very early. Why did Duraev need to go on Contender Series to get into the UFC? Because based on merit alone, he could have been in a long time ago. It was so strange to see him there. He was a giant favorite in that fight too, finished it by first round submission. It was really weird, and from the picture that I used for the graphic and listened straight up, I spent about an hour, and I'm not joking, trying to find a good side profile picture of Albert Duraev. They're hard to find. They crop out the bottom of him, so I went with him in jeans holding two belts. You get one belt, but then it hides his stats. So listen, the things that you can't see, I'll tell you. He has 3 wins by knockout, 3 losses by knockout. He has 9 wins by submission. He himself has never been submitted. So you chalk that all up, you get 12 wins, and then he has 2 wins by decision. But for Duraev, it's definitely his ground game that's his bread and butter. But I want to circle back to that question that I asked. Why did he have to go on Contender Series? Maybe inactivity? It's weird. It's really
like
weird.
Antonina Shevchenko, when she fought on there, she was a massive favorite against someone. No, like, it seems like once a year, there's always one of those guys where it's like, why do they have to prove themselves? They've done more than a Chidi and Jokuwani.
So they get the small contract.
No. I understand what the UFC's doing. It's unfortunate
so
that
they
this
don't have to pay them their money.
I know, but it's unfortunate that this is the way that guys like this have to get into the UFC. It's kind of like in baseball when you have a really good prospect in AAA and the team's like, oh, we're going to keep him down in AAA.
Let's
though.
Let's manipulate
until
that service.
Exactly.
Time.
Let's wait until our whole team becomes good, then we'll wait to pay them. It kind of feels like that's what the UFC's doing with Duraev.
So for Duraev, you know what you're going to get if you watch him over with ACB, if you're a big fan of the organization, because there were a lot of great prospects over there, Pyotr Yan included, who's in the co-main event. For Kopylov, that's the fun part. So Duraev was one of those guys where he was a welterweight champ, and then he missed weight, and they stripped him of his belt, so he had to start competing at middleweight, and then he won the belt, and then he defended the belt at middleweight, and it's a lot of fun there. For Kopylov, he was a former, and I want to make sure I get it right, Russian and European combat sambo champion. He was a hand-to-hand combat champion. He also was the Fight Nights Global middleweight champion. And I remember getting ready for his UFC debut against old K1 Carl, really out of glory, kickboxing, who just announced that one of our favorite Canadians, Joseph Altolini, is going to be a Hall
Bazooka
of Famer.
Joe.
But for Kopylov, I read a preview from Sean Bitter with Cage Side Press, and I put a lot of stock into what Sean puts out, the MMA wizard. And he had such high praise for Kopylov and the fact that he's going to be a future ranked guy. He's going to be fighting that great level competition. His striking's so good. He draws guys out. He throws a lot of good feints. His boxing's crisp. His defensive jiu-jitsu's good. He's good in every single aspect of MMA. So they matched him up with, in his debut, a very, very experienced fighter in Carl Robertson at home in Russia. And he really wasn't able to get it done. And that fight, Matt, it seems in my mind's eye like it was only yesterday. It was almost 2 years ago.
And nothing went well for Kopylov. It was just a really odd fight. Like with Carl Roberson, listen, on paper, one of the trickier fighters probably, if you just want to read his resume. He's got good offensive submissions, good defensive submissions. He's a great striker. But when you watch Carl Roberson fight, you kind of know what you're going to get. It's kind of, okay, all of the skills are good, but it's the in-betweens that he really struggles with. And I thought Roman would have a lot of success in that fight, but it was odd. It was like, okay, on the outside, I'm going to have a lot of trouble with the range. On the inside, I'm just going to kind of question myself and my own skills. It was one of those really, really weird performances. And not to steal any of your fire, but I'll kind of call myself out. I don't know if it's one of those fights that I should put a lot of stock into just when I look forward in the career of Kopylov, or if that's one of those like UFC jitters, you fought a really tricky guy. Is that what it is? And on the flip side with Duraev, I have one really important question, and I don't even know if this fight's going to answer it for us. We've seen a lot of guys who are champs outside of the UFC, even Paddy Pimblett, for instance. He was the featherweight and the lightweight champ, and at some point, all these champs do have to make a decision as to what weight class am I going to actively compete in the UFC. And I know with Duraev, it is a little bit different. He did miss weight and was forced to move up in weight, but I guess my question for you is, do you think his ceiling would have been higher down at 170 because I think his skills translate quite well up a weight class, but similar to what we saw with Grant Dawson last weekend, if Grant Dawson had done what he did to Ricky Glenn at 145 for the first two rounds, I don't think he would have tired himself out as much because he's so much bigger physically at 145, so I think the takedown would have come a little bit easier for him. Do you think Duraev could have a similar issue at 185 in the UFC, which is these bigger guys, because his game really is built around getting that offensive takedown?
Well, I mean, I look at Duraev's overall record, and the guy that he beat that really impressed me, he beat UFC vet Clifford Starks. You want to see a UFC run? Clifford Starks had a UFC run. And then he had a couple more wins, but for me, the one is against Piotr Struz in a card that got thrown around here and there. It was booked a few different times, then it finally happened. Struz, to me, is a good fighter, and for Duraev to pick up a win like that at 185, it shows that, hey, you have that strength where you can get guys down, you can muscle them around, you can have a really good fight. It all depends on where the fight takes place for Duraev, but he's going to want it on the mat. Can Kapilov keep it standing? And Kapilov, for what it's worth, is going to be the bigger fighter going in there. This fight all depends on how powerful and how long Duraev can last in there. So I look at the odds for this one. Duraev opened the favorite minus 180. He's a minus 279 right now on best fight odds. Kapilov opened a plus 155. He's a plus 221 right now. The Tapology votes, wow, 655 of them, 94% Duraev, 69% by submission. For the 6% that have Kapilov, 49% by knockout, 41% by decision. For Duraev, yeah, he's got three knockout losses. Let's talk about them. Anatoly Tarkov, Ramzan Ameev, Evgeny Fomenko. Okay, Fomenko not included. Ameev's a pretty good fighter. Should have beat Danny Roberts, whatever you want to say. Anatoly Tarkov, well, he just won last night on the Fedor card. So for me, I do like Duraev with the skill set, but man, this is a tough fight because Kapilov was so highly touted coming into his debut. He's had a lot of time to work through any issues in his game. He's a guy that has been booked in fights. I mean, hell, we had a graphic. He's supposed to fight, who was it? Sam Alvey not that long ago. Back in July, some visa issues there. He's booked with Tom Breeze and Eric Spicely as well in the last little bit, but he had to withdraw from some of those. So for me, it really is tough because Kapilov's still very highly thought of. And if he fought Sam Alvey, I know he would have won that fight. So this really is a tricky fight for both guys.
No, I agree 100%. I do like your pick, though, of Duraev. I do feel like he's just the more, I don't even really want to say consistent, because I do think there's a version of Kapilov out there who could mop the doors with Duraev, just absolutely look amazing, and then we completely change our opinion of Kapilov. I still think this could be the matchup. I do like the overall grappling of Duraev, and the great thing about Duraev's grappling is that even if he doesn't get the submission, it's still going to wear you out to where if it does go back to the feet, you're going to be a lesser version of yourself. And I do think it's going to take a little bit of the pop off the shots of Roman in this fight. So I agree with your pick. I do like Duraev.
Duraev just won a month ago on Dana White's Contender Series for Kapilov, the young-faced man in this fight. His last win against Yasube Enomoto with AMC was 2 years and 9 months ago. I'm going with Albert Duraev in this one, but I want to hear from you down below in the comment section. Do you have Duraev, or is the prospect hype train back with Kapilov? Because there's definitely a world where that could happen. There's a lot of different possibilities and variables in this fight. Want to hear from you down below. And out there on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, you rate and review it. We have fun with this one. Matt, I can't wait for this card. Up a weight class in the main event. Jan Blachowicz defending his belt against Glover Teixeira. Should be a great one. Let's keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Big time fight coming up this weekend at featherweight. We have Brazil's Ricardo Ramos taking on the man himself out of Russia, the forever prospect, Zubair Tokugov. His nickname is Warrior, and he has been so, but it's been a tricky run of late. And for Tokugov, you look at it at the 5-1 in, the trouble is there's losses sprinkled in there, there's wins sprinkled in there, and the big trouble is that there's a lot of inactivity because he beat Felipe Nover 6 years ago. Then he loses a split decision to Renato Moicano 5 years and 4 months ago. He draws with Lerone Murphy 2 years ago. He beats Kevin Aguilar by knockout 1 year and 7 months ago. His last fight was a loss to Hakeem Dawodu by split decision, and that was a really fun fight. And you know exactly what you're going to get out of Zubair Tokugov. You're going to get some striking. It's going to initiate his clinch work, and when he gets you down, it's just rinse and repeat. He's a guy that can chain his takedowns together, and yes, it's a comp to the gym that he comes out of and the buddies that he makes friends with out of AKA and the connections that he has with Islam Makhachev, with Khabib Nurmagomedov. The same thing can't be said out of Ricardo Ramos because he's taken a different direction. He was a striker, who became a grappler, and he got better and better with the connection at Team Alpha Male. Now, in the graphics here for Jim, we have Team Alpha Male for Hamosh. The weird thing is, if you go peep on his Instagrams, it looks like he could have some Team Alpha Male guys with him in Abu Dhabi for this one, but he spent the majority of his training camp in Brazil getting ready for this one, and that kind of gives me a little bit of pause, because I think if he would have stayed in the States and worked his wrestling, it could have accentuated his striking a little bit more against a guy like Takugov, who his bread and butter is to take you down, rinse and repeat.
What I will say is, Ricardo Hamosh feels like one of those fighters who, he may have learned everything he could have from Team Alpha Male. Maybe he was only there for the level of training partner and not for the knowledge itself. So honestly, I think the camp switch could be a positive. It could be similar to Vicente Luque. He might not be a full-time member of Sanford MMA right now, but he still has a great relationship with all those guys. If you ever see Gilbert Burns training at Sanford MMA, in a lot of those videos, Vicente Luque is still there. It's just he's not having his primary training camp at that gym. So I do understand your hesitation with the move. I don't always think it's a massive negative. And I do think Hamosh could be one of those fighters where it's like, okay, I'm going to take the wrestling and the boxing from these guys, and now I'm just going to try to incorporate that with what I'm doing down in Brazil. I don't have a good read on Hamosh whatsoever, though. I really thought Bill Algeo was going to blow the doors off him on the feet. I thought he'd be able to take him down if he had to. I thought Algeo would have had Hamosh's number completely, and I could not have predicted that fight any more incorrectly. And that's why I'm throwing up a red flag right now for me, because I don't think I have either one of these guys' games down to a T, and I could probably bring up a pretty compelling reason for why either guy could win this fight. I could see Takugov going out there, kind of overwhelming Hamosh with some of his strikes in the inside, and just rinse and repeat with his wrestling, make this a boring fight. But on the flip side, we've seen Hamosh fight on the inside before. He's got good knees. He's got great elbows. You don't need me to tell you that. The UFC's probably showed you that highlight reel of him over poor Ayman Zahabi 1,000 times now.
I did it once. It worked. 5 seconds later, I'll do it twice! And then I knock him out.
It's one of the most beautiful knockouts in the, like, it really, it's one of the more underrated knockouts, I think, in UFC history. People don't bring that up as much as they should.
Because it was a giant card and there were three title fights.
Exactly. But what it speaks to is the overall fight IQ of Ricardo Hamosh. Yes, he was just using that same technique over again, but if it lands once, you might as well try it again to see if it lands. And that's been the key with Hamosh. With fighters who give him time to build up and have success on the outside, you're going to have a lot of trouble, because if you let him sort of build to his best, he's got great shots on the outside. He is kind of like a, I hate to say Renato Moicano because it is a similar comparison to a former opponent of Takugov, but I really do think that if you watch that Renato Moicano fight, you can take a lot from that performance and really apply it to how Takugov's gonna at least try to fight Hamosh.
It's gonna be a really, really tricky one for both guys. For the 5-1 in on Hamosh, you look at it, there's a loss 2 years, almost 3 years ago to Saeed Nurmagomedov. He beats Journey Newson, he beats Eduardo Garrigori by submission, he loses to Lerone Murphy by knockout, and he beats Bill Algeo. The level of competition for both guys over the years is really strange. Hamosh is a guy that's fought close to us in Portland, Maine. He fought on an NEF card, or no, I don't even think it was Portland. I think it was actually, it was in Bangor, because it was Dana White's looking for a fight, so it was in Bangor. But crazy stuff, wild card, and yeah, he fought a decent fighter on that one too. But when I look at this one, Hamosh definitely has the game in terms of the striking. It all depends on how the takedown defense can stand up, as well as his sneaky, sneaky jiu-jitsu game, especially if he's off his back.
Do you think he can threaten with submissions in this fight? Because I think he can. I just don't think he can secure them personally. I do think he's going to have a really hard time actually latching onto the submission. Similar to Brian Ortega, Alexander Volkanovski. Ortega, the reason that fight was so crazy is Ortega had those submissions locked in. It was more Volkanovski fighting his way out of them. I don't know if Hamosh is able to get to that actual locked in position. I think he might threaten off his back with some Kimura grips to try to force a sweep or at least force a scramble. I do worry about Hamosh's ability just purely off his back though in this fight. I think he's a fighter who can somewhat get held down, because this thing about Hamosh, in top position, he is a nightmare to deal with. He can threaten with his own submissions. He's got good ground and pound. He is a fighter who can get held down though defensively, and I think that's where Takugov is going to have a lot of his success.
We'll have to see how working with Team Alpha Male over the last few years has worked out for Hamosh, but the odds for this one, they open to par. Takugov now a -170 favorite. For Hamosh, he's a +140 underdog or thereabouts. The Tapology votes, Matt, I'm going to guess 65% over-under for Takugov.
I'll say under. I think it'll be close.
Why not that close. I'm 695 total votes. 75% Takugov, 79% by decision. 25% with Hamosh, 80% by decision. I would think Hamosh the more likely guy to get a finish win out of this one. Again, the blueprint's already there with a buddy. You just have to talk to Saeed Nurmagomedov, call him up. Hey, How'd you get it done? Well, I finished him. I did it.
Back kick.
That's the thing. Guys that have knockout abilities can beat Hamosh. Have wrestlers had that much success against him? Have they been beating him consistently in the UFC? Not necessarily. And for Hamosh, and to his credit, he beat a guy that can grapple in Bill Algeo's last time out, who that's his bread and butter.
He's a very different kind of grappler, though. With Algeo, it's more, I'm a defensive grappler. I wait for your takedown attempts. I wrap you up. Takyugov is much more of that traditional kind of wrestler, and that's why I do think Hamosh is going to have a really hard time in this fight. He can defend those body grip takedowns, because that's more clinch fighting than actual takedown defense. I think with Takyugov, he's in on your hips so fast, and the second Hamosh does let his hands go, he's not going to actually let his hands be by their hips, which is where they're probably going to need to be when you're fighting a guy like Takyugov. I hate saying this, but I really do think Takyugov's going to make this a boring fight, and it's probably going to be his best path to victory.
If Hamosh wins this fight, you're going to jump out of your seat. You're going to throw your pot and popcorn. I see this fight as one of those ones. I like Takyugov, though, because even though he's a forever prospect with over 20 fights, and I'm going to compare him to Eric Silva that way, when I look at that overall body of work and then what he does in the cage, he has a very, very high motor, and I like a guy like that to just continue to go to the well, rinse and repeat. I like that in this fight too. So both of us going with Rasha Zubera Takyugov. I can't wait for this fight. If you like Hamosh or Takyugov, strongly and kindly let us know down below in the comments section. We have a giant card coming up that we cannot wait for. So let's get into it, Matt, and keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. I'm just going to keep saying it, as we always say, let's get into it. Big time fight coming up on the prelims of UFC 267 in the strawweight division. We have an all-Brazilian showcase at strawweight between Amanda Ribas and Vina Jandjidova. And Matt, I absolutely love this fight because we've seen from both of these women that they can get it done not just outside of the octagon with some of the smaller promotions, but since they've joined in, ooh boy, has it been a fun run. And for Vina Jandjidova, look no further than her last fight against Kaneko Murata with her Olympic-level Japanese wrestling. She comes into that fight. Vina, is she going to be able to defend the takedowns? If she is, what's she going to be able to do on the feet? Because we know how good Vina is when it goes to the mat. She is in her own element right there. And in that fight, Vina broke Kaneko Murata's arm with her strikes. Like, it's absolutely crazy how that fight went. For Amanda Ribas, you know exactly how good her power is. And I don't necessarily like to go too far into the well with the stats, but I just want to throw this one out very early just to set the bar. For Amanda Ribas, with strikes landed per minute, 4.25 to 1.78 taken, that's at a 44% accuracy clip, 71% her striking defense. Those stats are almost impeccable, Matt. They're insane. You rarely ever see that in MMA, let alone in the strawweight division. For Vina, they're definitely at a negative. They actually are at a negative. Like, when you compare her strikes landed to her strikes taken, her percentage is all right, but she really gets it done with having a high motor, getting a lot of takedowns, and she is good in the in-betweens when it comes to her grappling, to getting it down to the mat, to getting the submission when she does choose to get it down there. It's all going to depend, like No Jacket Required by Phil Collins. Listen, who's going to be able to take me home? The only thing I know is that Amanda Ribas' dad took home one of the weirdest tattoos I've ever seen on his arm.
This is a really weird fight, not to mention that tattoo. I'll get to that in a second. I just have a lot on my mind right now. This is a very, very odd fight because for Amanda Ribas, her highs are very high, but they're not over any fighters you want them to be over.
Spitfire Whitmire.
Exactly. And Paige VanZant.
Mackenzie Dern,
who is a good fighter, but even the Mackenzie Dern fight, like, there's some weird variables that never get brought up about that fight. It's weird. When Mackenzie Dern beat Nina Nunes, everybody mentioned the fact right after that fight, and it was like, hey, Nina just came back from having a kid. Amanda Ribas had the exact same type of experience with Mackenzie Dern. I feel like that's not brought up enough. Listen, no one believes in Mackenzie Dern at this weight class more than me over here, but the problem is that she didn't look very good in that Amanda Ribas fight, and I do think a large part of that was the fact that Dern came off of a very lengthy layoff, and it wasn't just like, oh, I broke my wrist and now I'm coming back. She had a kid. That's a really big layoff that changes your body a lot, that prevents you from training at a really high level while you're taking all this time off. It's just, with Amanda Ribas, there's a fighter that you could get sold if you just look at her record and you're thinking, wow, she's got great ability to strike on the outside. She's a very physically strong fighter for this weight class. She has an amazing ability to finish her submissions on the mat. But the issue is that against all those fighters that she looks so good against, they're not really the highest levels of competition. Like, right now, it is easy to say that Amanda Ribas' best UFC win is over Okay, probably Mackenzie Dern, now that I think about it. But really, you could say Paige VanZant if you wanted to. Like, that's the type of fighters that we're talking about as to who has Hibas had success against in the past. And the thing about Hibas, too, that I feel like has to get brought up, she didn't even fight Paige VanZant at 115 pounds. And I guess this is just my big rant that I'm going to go off for like 45 seconds, if you don't mind.
Make it quick.
With Amanda Hibas, I don't know if she's in the right weight class or not at strawweight, and that's just always something I think about. This was a point that got brought up before her last fight against Marina Rodriguez, and I remember thinking about this a lot on Fight Week. Amanda Hibas isn't a fighter who cuts like 3 pounds to make weight. She cuts 12 kilograms to make strawweight. There was a report that came out and a whole article that came out right after her fight on the, Poirier McGregor undercard, the prelims, where, yeah, after her weight cut, she gained 12 kilograms. That's a lot of weight for someone that small to be cutting and trying to rehydrate back. Like, Paulo Costa was expected to cut a similar amount of weight. If he would have gone all the way down to 185 pounds, the UFC just said, nah, don't worry about those 20 pounds, because that's the type of weight he was cutting, and he's a much bigger guy than Amanda Hibas. All I'm trying to say is that when you're a fighter who's this small fighting at strawweight, those 12 kilograms mean a lot more than, like, a middleweight trying to make their way down to 185. With Amanda Hibas, more than any other fighter at this weight class, I do worry about her fight week with her fight with the scale.
And it's going to be interesting, too, because something like that could be to her advantage when you're trying to defend takedowns against Vina Jandjidouba, whose UFC wins include, like we said, Kanako Murata, Mallory Martin, who's a good wrestler, and Felice Herrig. She submitted her. Her loss is Mackenzie Dern. It's a unanimous decision win for Dern, but it was a very close back-and-forth fight. Another fight she had was against Carla Sparza. She lost by decision, but for Dern, bread and butter on the ground, but they both struck. Again, great opportunity for Hibas there. Against Carla Sparza, another back-and-forth fight. Obviously, Hibas, the younger fighter in this one, by a fair margin. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see how she bounces back from that loss, training at American Top Team. Matt, when I look at the odds for this one, Hibas, the favorite, open at minus 120. She's minus 159 right now. For Kakara, Vina Jandjidouba, she opened the underdog, of course, around a minus 110. She's now a plus 131. We look at the topology votes, and I'm going to hazard to guess over under 85% Hibas.
I think they'll be under.
Look at that. 781 total votes, 77% Hibas, 86% by decision for the 23% that have Jandjidouba, 58% by decision. I think Vina Jandjidouba goes out there like Pollyanna Viana, gets a finish over Amanda Hibas and submits her on the ground.
I disagree. Now, I think she can get a finish, but this is my problem with saying that Jandjidouba can just go in there and submit Hibas. We haven't seen Hibas get out-grappled consistently in the UFC up until this point. And yes, Verna is going to be the best grappler she's faced up until this point, but not really, I guess. She fought Mackenzie Dern and she did fairly well against her. I guess even I forgot that. This is going to be a really interesting fight, because I don't think it's as cut and dry as, if Jandjidouba gets this to the mat, she's definitely going to win. And I don't think it's as easy as, oh, if Hibas can keep this on the feet, she's definitely going to win. I do think there's a bit of a yin and yang in their games, and I do think both fighters can have success no matter what phase this fight takes place at. This is what I do always resort my mindset going back to, and it's, if Jandjidouba can get the takedown, I think it's gonna be one of those like bend don't break type of situations where if she gets the takedown, I think she'll be able to win enough minutes and enough moments on the mat to where Hibas is gonna be really, really hesitant on her feet from that moment on in the fight. So for me, I hate to say this, but I really do think this fight in the pick comes down to who gets early success first. I really do think if Hibas is able to establish her range, stay on the outside, you're just going to be forcing Jandjidouba to basically jump across the cage into her takedowns. And I think Hibas has more than enough footwork to really be able to pepper her jab and her kicks in on the outside and work her way to a 50-minute decision that way. But again, on the flip side, if Jandjidouba gets that takedown early, I do think she can have similar success as this fight goes on. I'm just kind of talking myself into which pick I'm going to go with, but I had Hibas, but I honestly think you've talked me into picking Jandjidouba.
So what's the pick?
I think Verna's going to be able to get it done. I actually do. All week, or I guess all day, I thought Amanda Hibas is going to be able to have enough success on the outside to force Verna to become a striker with her. But the more I think about it, I do think Verna's going to be able to make this fight more of a clinch matchup. And I do think in the clinch, Amanda Hibas has a really hard time getting her opposition off of her. And I think that since Hibas isn't going to be going for her own offensive takedowns, I do think Jandjidouba, just stylistically, is going to offer a really interesting look for Hibas.
Vina Jandjidouba.
Jandjidouba.
Jandjidouba is how John Anik goes with it. And Matt, another one off a no jacket required. It's a long, long way to go. A long, long way to go. We'll really recap this one on question mark kicks, but right now, both of us going with the Brazilian fighter. Avina Janjidova to get the win. I can't wait for this one. I can see a lot of people barking mad at their TV, at their PlayStation, at their Xbox, at their phone. You let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this fight. Because for Matt, it was a long and winding road, and he had a hard time deciding.
I did.
For you, maybe it's not. You let us know down below. And Matt, we have some big-time fights coming up. We have a Brazilian in the main event looking to stake his claim to be the best 205er in the world. Glover Teixeira taking on Jan Blachowicz. I can't wait for it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Ah, ow! Oh my god! Oh no, it's a bloodbath in here! There's gotta be a better way to get my dagger clean and shiny safely than this. This is what I used to deal with when I cut myself, and you've heard me talk about this before, but when shaving before, I knew about Manscaped, the sponsor for today's video. Thank you, Manscaped, for keeping my dagger slick and ready for wherever the night takes me. It's my bed with my wife. That's about it. Manscaped is trusted by over 2 million men worldwide. Join the movement by going to manscaped.com. You're going to get 20% off and free shipping with the code FNP. Matt, I don't normally talk about my wife's profession, but she's an esthetician. And she went to school for it. She runs her own spot for it. She has a lot of fun doing it. Maybe she prefers waxing to shaving. But when it comes to Craig, I'm not waxing my nuts. That's not safe. Ow. You tear your ball skin. You're in a bad spot. Now, I've never done that before, but I have nicked and, grazed and gotten in some bad spots with those cheaper department store blades. And that's the worst part of it. You know, you've been there before. You figure, oh, I'm going to save myself a little bit of money. I'm going to go to one of the big box stores. I'll get the package. I'll get home. I'll be happy with myself. And what normally happens?
Your shower lining ends up looking like the elevator from The Shining.
I mean, that rhyme, but I don't know who has a shower lining. I don't know, like a shower curtain?
I don't know what kind of rhyme. I thought it was fun.
All right, but this is what I do know. It's time to end the days of shaving your balls and having them end up look like a horror movie. Because the folks at Manscaped, what they've done is they have the perfect package for your package to get this done. It's the perfect package 4.0. You've heard us talk about it, and if you've been on the fence for this long, hey, you should join the club. There's over 2 million men in it. What I can say is you're going to get the Lawnmower 4.0. You see that puppy working 4,000K LED light. And the best part about it, I don't know many people. Now, I have been in the occasional shower that has a light. It's nice and protected. But most people, myself included, have a dark enough shower. So if you do pick this up, you get to see what you're doing. But the other nice thing, we're on a Sunday taping these videos. A bit of inside baseball here. I'm going to be going away tomorrow for the week. 1, 2, 3. Bang, bang, bang. My LEDs are going up. I hit that button. That puppy's locked. They've got a travel lock on there. 1, 2, 3. LEDs are going down. And look at that. Now I'm good to use it. So it's not going to pop on and off in your travel case when you're going around. It's got a slick and neat cover. Look at that. What I do know is the fact that it is a very nice gift. If you pick it up for yourself, if you pick it up for somebody else, you're going to get the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant. You spit that stuff on like a bit of a salve in the morning. The one that I really like, this one's a Crop Reviver. It is a ball toner. And you talk about spritzing. You put a little bit of that on. It's going to keep everything high and tight, nice and fresh for the day. And then the other thing that you're going to get, my favorite part of this whole thing, the Weed Whacker. Now, it's an experience like none other. 360-degree motor. You can clean it out. You just take the top off, clean it out, oil it up if you need to. But the best part is, now I haven't shaved my nose in a little bit. Oh, my goodness. I mean, stuff gets going up there. So, if you pick it out, it's going to be a great deal for you. Listen, and if you also get the Performance Package 4.0, you get the Shed Travel Bag and the Manscaped Boxers. And they're definitely a go-to key item you got to have in your wardrobe. So get 20% off with the code FNP at manscaped.com. Spend spooky season using the best tools for the job at Manscaped. Matt, we've been rocking with Manscaped for a while. They treated us well.
Yeah.
You've checked them out. You've helped out the channel. So get 20% off free shipping with code FNP at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping. Use the code FNP. Slay your worst pubes and keep your dagger clean with Manscaped this holiday season. Matt, we have a big-time banger of a co-main event. We have a big-time banger of a main event. Piotr Jan taking on Corey Sandhagen for the interim bantamweight strap. And in the main event, Jan Blachowicz looking to make it 2 straight defenses at 205 pounds. He's taking on Glover Teixeira. Can't wait for it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it.
I'm
absolute banger. Coming up this weekend at light heavyweight, we have a couple of guys that with a win, who knows where they're at in this division. It is always in flux. We have Russia's Magomed Ankalaev taking on Switzerland's Volkan Oezdemir. No time. And Matt, listen, I was fortunate to have one of the first interviews on the channel was actually Volkan Oezdemir before his fight with Anthony Smith in Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada. We know how that one turned out. There was time. There was time for Anthony Smith to take over after he got beat up in the clinch, then do his own work to get the takedown, to get the submission win. And that fight actually happens to be in the 5-on-in for Volkan Oezdemir. His fifth to last fight was against Smith almost 3 years ago. Then he loses split decision to Dominic Reyes. Say what you will about that one. If you thought that he won it, he knocks out Aleer Latifi his next time out. He beats Alexander Rakic almost 2 years ago, but did Rakic win that fight? That was a very close one. All I know is that in his last fight, a year and 3 months ago, he fought a man that we know from Czech Republic. His name is Jiří Procházka. When he's not punching and kicking trees, he's meditating in the mountains. And when he's not doing that, well, sometimes he almost gets knocked out by Dominic Reyes. Sometimes Volkan Oezdemir hits him with clean shots. And what does he do? Turns away in the middle of the fight like he's Nick Diaz in his prime, fires back, and knocks Volkan out cold. He sent him into the stratosphere, like where William Shatner was with Jeff Bezos. You could probably beep, beep. Is that Volkan Oezdemir out there? I don't know. But for Volkan, all of this to say, the losses haven't been pretty. And when I look at his last four losses, if you lump it in, because he was on a three-fight losing streak at one point, he lost to Daniel Cormier, where he got into a mounted crucifix and couldn't get that small big man off the top of him. So for Oezdemir, what does he do so good? What got him to the dance? It was those no time quick knockout wins where we're just bang, 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 knocking fools out. But lately, his last two wins, I mean, Latifi, he knocked him out. But if you look at it, Reyes fight, and then you look at it in the Rakic fight, maybe not so.
I don't think we're giving Volkan Oezdemir enough credit for being a pretty good technician on the feet. Because I really do think he's one of the more, I don't want to say most technical guys at light heavyweight, because right now, for instance, Jan Blachowicz, your champion.
Magomed Ankalaev.
Magomed Ankalaev. But with Volkan, I don't think you can just look at the knockouts and think, oh, he's like Wanderlei Silva. He just goes in there, brawls, and if he catches you with a shot, that's great. Volkan Oezdemir's got some really good technique at this weight class too, and that's what does kind of set him apart, or that's what at least set him apart on his initial title run, because I remember it clear as day. They brought him in at short notice to fight Ovin St. Preux. A lot of people thought, oh, well, OSP, listen, he lost to John Jones. Jimmy Manuwan lost to him. He's going to beat some guy on short notice. And was it the most entertaining fight in the world? No, not at all. And does OSP have a good argument for winning that fight? Yeah, kind of. But for Volkan Oezdemir to just show up in the UFC and beat a guy who was, you know, pretty fresh coming off a title shot, that was really, really impressive. And from that moment on, he just kept on building on that momentum. In the OSP fight, we learned that, yes, he has good technical kickboxing on the outside, and then he added the power to go along with it right afterwards. And that's what made Oezdemir such a fun contender, or at least such a threatening contender at the time for Daniel Cormier. Because, yes, right now it's kind of funny, okay, Oezdemir should have been in there with Cormier. There's levels to this. But at the time, like, there were a lot of people thinking Oezdemir had a good chance of beating Cormier. Cormier came off that knockout loss to John Jones. There were a lot of question marks around his chin at 205, especially against a big puncher like Oezdemir. I feel like people kind of forgot the fighter that Volkan Oezdemir was, and they only remember him for being the guy who got knocked out by Procházka and for just being outthought by a guy like Dominic Reyes. Just, the highs have been very high for Oezdemir, but the lows have also been quite low.
You can't see it, but again, in a dark corner over there, it says, what, fastest knockout, 15 seconds. For Volkan Oezdemir. Now let's focus on Magomed Ankalaev. Let's go 5-on-in. He beats Klitson Abreu. He beats Dalcho Lindjambul, a disgusting knockout. He beats Iwan Kutsalaba. He beats Iwan Kutsalaba. He beats Nikita Krylov. And the most interesting part about that Krylov fight is he faced adversity in the first round, and then he rallied back in the second, rallied back in the third. And for Ankalaev, what's the best part about him? Well, that's actually hard for me to try and figure out what is his best path to victory, because I know he can wrestle. I know he can grapple. I know he's one of the most technical snipers in this division. He has so many different fun techniques and aspects to his game, and that's why it's tough to really kind of rag on him in one thing. Maybe he's not the quickest starter, but then sometimes he is against, you know, an E1 in a firefight. And listen, I don't care. For anybody out there, for a guy, there was some people that chirped us when we did the breakdown. There was some people in the second breakdown. They hit up the comments section. He didn't knock out Kutsalaba the first time. He knocked him out, and then he did it twice, and it was just as nice. So, Matt, Ankalaev comes into this fight against Uzdemir where maybe he's finally met his match here.
I think there's a really good fighter in Ankalaev, but I do think there's some things that he's going to struggle with when he does find more consistent high-level opposition. Now, he has looked really good as of late, but right now Ankalaev could easily be put in, like, the Junior Dos Santos category, where it's like, yeah, you look good.
Yeah, you get knocked out every time.
Yeah, you look good, but you've looked good against Iwan Kutalaba. It's kind of like JDS, or sorry, with Cain Velasquez. Like, yeah, you look really good, but your four biggest wins, two of them are over Bigfoot Silva, two of them are over JDS. It's just, do you just fight that one type of fighter really, really well, or is there a great fighter there? Now, I believe Magomed Ankalaev is going to be in the top five sooner rather than later, but I do think there's some fighters in the top rankings who are going to give him trouble. Like, I think Ankalaev would struggle with the overall activity of a guy like Anthony Smith. I know he has much more power than Anthony Smith. I think with Ankalaev, there are some matchups out there, especially in the top 15, that he will find himself struggling in that he hasn't up until this point. Now, with the Krylov fight, it's hard to look good against Nikita Krylov. It's not like Ankalaev looked like some world beater in that matchup. If you want to point to that fight and say, hey, Nikita Krylov had a good start against Magomed Ankalaev, Volkan Uzdemir could do the same, I can't disagree with you, but it's really hard to go out there and look great against Nikita Krylov. Few guys go out there, defend every takedown attempt, force him to become a striker, and just knock him out. It's really hard to look good against a guy like Nikita Krylov because he hides his head well, he can scramble, he's just so well-rounded and crafty, so I don't put a lot of stock into that fight. What I do put a lot of stock into, though, is look at how Ankalaev beat Kutalaba. He waited for him to engage with his looping shots and then just met him with power going right down the middle. If Volkan Uzdemir is going to have success in this fight, it's going to come from that low calf kick, but it's also going to come from looping shots on the feet. And I think when you're throwing looping shots against a guy like Ankalaev, you're just asking to get knocked out.
Fast twitch muscles down the pipe with power usually always beat looping shots. Usually there's a few anomalies out there, like if Justin Gaethje comes in and decides to throw hammers, or if Mason Jones and David Onama decide to throw down every now and again, you get the guy with a little bit of power and lasting staying power to be able to get the win. But yeah, when I look at this one, the odds, Ankalaev heavy favorite, open a -290, he's a -332. Uzdemir open a +235, he's now a +255 or thereabouts. The Tapology votes, I don't know what they are. Now I do. 794 of them. 92% Ankalaev, 34% by decision, 58% by knockout for the 8% that have Uzdemir, 44% by decision, 43% by knockout. I would be incredibly surprised if Uzdemir won by decision, which might seem silly because he could have beat Dominic Reyes by decision, depending on how you saw the fight. And he might have lost, but he did win against Rakic. You catch where I'm going with this one? Uzdemir can last in there against very, very good fighters, but Ankalaev has been different. I know the lone blemish on his record was that Hail Mary last second submission by Aaron Rodgers in like 2015. It was like, whoop, we're throwing that ball up there. And Paul Craig gets that submission win. But for me, when I look at this one, Ankalaev has all of the tools to nullify Uzdemir's game.
I'm going to say this, though. I wouldn't be surprised at all if Uzdemir won by knockout. I know we say that a lot on fights, and I'll be honest, sometimes I disagree with you when you say it. You might disagree with me saying this now, but I actually do think Uzdemir has an all-right chance of winning this. Even though you look at the Tapology votes and what were they, 92% said Ankalaev, like, I think Uzdemir has a decent shot. He throws good combinations for a light heavyweight fighter. He's got good hand speed for this division, and I don't think he has bad cardio by any means for the size of fighter that he is, so I could see a world where Uzdemir goes out there, he's able to defend a few grappling exchanges from Ankalaev, and they just kind of find themselves both winging power shots in the feet. If that's the kind of fight we get, that is a very winnable fight for Uzdemir, but I do agree with you. I think Ankalaev is the more technical guy on the feet, and I do think the technique will eventually win out.
Big time fight at light heavyweight. We have the main event coming up with Jan Blachowicz taking on Glover Teixeira. In this one, both of us going with Magomed Ankalaev. Now, this one is on the main card. You can join us for our Fight Night Picks Fight Companion. Our Fight Picks Night Companion. Whatever it is, it's the night before Halloween. I can't wait for these fights. Just keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. It's the return of the superstar Khamzat Chimaev coming back this weekend, taking on China's Li Jingliang, and I can't wait for this fight. I want to hear from you down below in the comments section who you have in this one. As always, one half of your host, Anil Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, as always, Matt Allen FNP on the respective socials. Matt, can you believe it? Khamzat's back. I mean, it's crazy. It's been such a long time. And that's the craziest thing, because you talk about breakout stars from 2020. There was Khamzat Chimaev. There was Kevin Holland. One guy burned right out. one guy, due to unfortunate circumstances, hasn't been able to fight, and you look at that crazy run that Chimaev went on to enter the UFC, beats John Phillips by submission, he beats Reese McKee by knockout, he beats Gerald Meerschaert by one-punch knockout, and then he just rides away into the sunset. He was like George Strait, the cowboy rides away. And when I look at this fight, Matt, this is such a banger on paper because Li Jingliang has had staying power in the UFC, he's had crazy finish wins. You look at that body shot that he lands against David Zavada. You look at his knockout win over perennial contender Argentina's own Santiago Ponzinibbio. Li Jingliang is the type of guy that the only knock against him that I had, I mean, the guy's well-rounded. He can hit you. He can wrestle you. He can go in there for dirty old submissions and eye hooks. But the one knock I had, and I went on this big diatribe, was that the fact that, well, he didn't really win outside of China or even Southeast Asia, to be specific. But here recently, that hasn't really mattered. And you look at that lone loss at the 5-on-in for Li Jingliang. It's to Neil Magny by decision. Hey, stuff like that's going to happen. So for Jingliang, very well-rounded, very tricky guy when he does kind of get into his groove because he throws a nice lead hook. His legs are built like tree trunks. His kicks are crazy. Can Li Jingliang withstand the pressure and the power of Khamzat Chimaev? Because Chimaev, is he some giantly accredited jiu-jitsu black belt? No, but he makes up for that in toughness, in heart, in metal, just everything that he brings into it. It's absolutely amazing, and that's why this fight is so much fun.
I feel like when you get into the cage with Khamzat Chimaev and you have that first like grappling exchange, you ever just play pickup basketball with like a guy who played football in university and you're defending them and you're like, oh, we're not like the same person. Like, yes, I might have better skills at this one thing than them, but it doesn't really matter because their level of athleticism. Chimaev looks like he has that type of strength. Like when he hits guys, they fall down. When he gets takedowns, no one defends them. And that really is the key with Chimaev. Everything he does is so physically strength heavy. And it will be really interesting just the progression of his career to see A, if he can stay more active, and B, what weight class will he settle into? Because I do think 170 is probably his best chance to eventually get a title. He's the bigger guy at this weight class. He just matches physically a lot better with these guys, I'd say, than some of those bigger middleweights do. You got to think about guys like Paulo, I guess he can't make the weight anymore.
Marvin Vittori,
exactly. Like even Robert Whittaker is a big guy. You know what I mean?
Cannonier.
Exactly. Like there's some really big guys at that weight class that I do think would give Chimaev a little bit of trouble with their just overall physicality. But at 170, Chimaev's just such a good wrestler. Like, no one has shown the ability to stop his takedown attempt at this weight class. It's kind of like my Sincero Eubanks at 125. Yes, at 135, we might have some question marks. But at 125 pounds, I haven't been proven wrong yet. And for Chimaev, it has been that case up until this point. He not only is just a really good frame for this weight class, he does have crazy physical strength. And he does have that weird intangible of, and I know this gets sound really cheesy, absurd self-belief. Like, that really is the thing you think about when it comes to Chimaev. If he doesn't get the takedown, he doesn't care. He's not going to stop just at the first sign of adversity. He will try to fight through any tough moments in this fight. And the opponent that they picked for Shamaya's return is really interesting. I want to get your opinion on this because I know for us, like, we get excited. Li Jingliang is coming back. He's fighting Khamzat Chimaev. But I feel like just to the broader UFC audience, this is sort of a weird return fight for Chimaev because I do think that the, you know, maybe the less than hardcore, they might know who Chimaev is, but I don't really think they know that, okay, if he gets a win over Li Jingliang, he's destined to be in the top 15 and those are the type of guys he should fight next.
Well, that's it. I mean, Li Jingliang right now, 11 in your rankings, and you look at it for Chimaev, of course, the long layoff, the COVID complications and such. He beats Gerald Meerschaert at 185, and then they match him up with top three ranked Leon Edwards three different times. The first time, Edwards tests positive for COVID. The fight's off. The second time, Chimaev had the COVID issues, I guess lingering issues. The third time, same thing. So again, are we going to get a depleted Chimaev? How's he going to look at 170? They're all things that scare me away from this, but again, Li Jingliang in the rankings, ahead of Santiago Ponzinibbio, ahead of Sean Brady, ahead of Muslim Salikov, ahead of D-Rod Daniel Rodriguez. Hopefully the hand injury is doing well. But again, ahead of Jingliang, Jeff Neal that just had a fight book, Bilal Muhammad, Neil Magny, Michael Chiesa. These are the fighters that Chimaev is in that breath with. I bring up the records, so let's have fun. Records are for DJs and they're for me. Power Windows by Rush. And listen, is it one of their most popular albums? Maybe not. Did I work with a guy that looked like this? You know him, actually, and he looks exactly like the guy from Power Windows. My favorite song off of this to describe this fight, I'll give you two. The Big Money. Well, The Big Money's on Khamzat Chimaev. He's a giant favorite. He's a promotional darling. But the other thing that I want to go with in this one is Mystic Rhythms. Because this guy moves in Mystic Rhythms when he's in the cage, and he hits like a ton of bricks. So for Shamayev, Matt, I'll bring up those odds just quickly. He opened a minus 260 favorite. He's a minus 456 right now. Jing Liang opened a plus 210. He's a plus 342. The Topology votes, a surprise test, they are to you. I'm going to assume over under 90% Shamayev.
Probably over, to be honest.
Wow. Ooh, under. 878 total votes, 85% Shamayev, 18% by decision, 23% by submission, 53% by knockout. For the 15% that have Li Jingliang, 68% by knockout. Again, the time away scares me off of like putting a big bet on Chimaev, because listen, he's looked like an absolute world beater his entire pro MMA career, and I love him as a fighter. Like, we were on that train before it became a giant hype train that left the station. You can go back and watch the videos, but I like Chimaev in this fight. Again, that's the only thing that really scares me away from a big bet.
I like Chimaev in this fight, but there's a lot of question marks surrounding just him and what is he going to look like with all of this time off. Because the thing that made Chimaev really special was how active he was. And the great thing about fighters who are really active, I always go back to what Bob Arum said about Muhammad Ali. If you look at Muhammad Ali's record, he fought like every month. You would think if you're a really big star, you're only fighting like two or three times a year. But if you listen to Bob Arum actually talk about it, it was that Muhammad Ali hated training. So the best way to know that he would stay in the gym and be active was, well, he's fighting all the time. He doesn't really have an excuse for not being active. I don't think Shamayev's cut from that cloth. It's always something that I do go back and think about when a guy's been really active and he's used to being, okay, I'm in a fight, I have a 3-week training camp, and I'm right back in a fight. That kind of activity is almost like a season for like an NBA player. It'll be really interesting to see how Shamayev does with all of this time off. Again, I'm not picking Li Jingliang, but I do think there's a world where he is able to win. He's got absurd punching power. He's as stiff as a board, oddly enough, and I feel like that's something I do have to mention that we didn't bring up yet. Li Jingliang doesn't really move like your traditional MMA fighter, and he's a phenomenal striker on the outside. He's got a great variety of strikes, but when you look at him striking, he's not really like an Israel Adesanya who's got this great fluidity to his movement. He fights like an old-timey boxer, almost.
He kind of strikes a pose, and listen, the picture we're looking at on Tapology where he's doing a bit of a celly, that's kind of what he looks like when he fights. Everything, like his muscles are tensed right up, like he's just so into it. But again, winning a lot more fights than he's losing against good competition.
And he has such deceiving power, too. Like, when you look at Li Jingliang, he is stiff. He doesn't really do anything in a traditional sense, but it doesn't mean it's not effective. That's really, I guess, just the point I'm trying to bring up. They're not just putting Khamzat Chimaev in there with some opponent, hoping he gets a win and can build his name off Li Jingliang. I really do think Jingliang is going to offer a really, really interesting opponent and a really interesting fight to Chimaev.
Matt, so what's the pick here?
I'm going to pick Chimaev. Now, I told Craig, I even grabbed this Ray Allen jersey. I thought I was going to be like, hey, long shot, like Ray Allen. Could I pick the big underdog? But no, I do think Shamayev's got it. It's hard to pick against a guy who is able to get a one-punch knockout win over Gerald Meerschaert. And I know what people are going to say. Meerschaert's got losses out there. But
Reese,
like,
McKee sucks. He's out of the UFC.
Reese McKee's maybe not the best opponent Chimaev could have had, but like, if I can see Gerald Meerschaert eat massive power punches from guys like Thiago Santos, from just other big power punchers in this division.
Makhmud Muradov.
Him able to absorb that power and respond with his own, he wasn't able to do that against Chimaev. Like, I really do think Chimaev is that kind of a fighter. Now, if he ever does fight Leon Edwards, maybe that's when I'll start to consider these other challengers and what they bring to the table against Chimaev. But for right now, as much as I want to be a contrarian, I do think I have to pick Khamzat.
Both of us going with All-Stars own Khamzat Chimaev in the return. The 2020 Phenom to get the win. Let us know down below in the comments section what you're thinking about this fight and the rest of them on the main card, where you can find us here on the channel. And if you're not subscribed already, you're going to miss the Fight Companion, and you're probably not going to contribute to those Dana White's Contender Series breakdown videos that we'll do if we're able to hit 30,000. We just topped 28. We're almost there to 30. Matt, I can't wait for this fight and the rest of the card. Let's keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say, let's get into it. At UFC Picture Day, one of these two guys looks a little bit more photogenic than the other guy, but neither one of them look like a beauty king. We have Alexander Volkov taking on Poland's Marcin Tybura, and I absolutely love this fight because we've seen, for old Marcin Tybura, the former M1 global champ, and you can say that about both of these guys, but for Tybura, he just... He had a rough patch, and then he was able to get out of it. And if you really do look at it for Tybura in the five on in, the last five fights are all wins. He's been very active. He beats Sergey Spivak. He beats Max Grecian. He beats Ben Rothwell, Greg Hardy, and Walt Harrison. His last two wins are both knockout wins. They're both finishes. So that's great for Tybura, a guy who, sneaky, is almost 36. He's like a week away from being 36. He's taking on Alexander Volkov, again, M1 Global Champ, a guy who's had tons of success outside of the UFC. The five on in, there's a couple of losses. Who are they to? All right, Curtis Blaydes and Ciryl Gane, both of those fights main events. And that's the thing. These guys have fought a very good level of competition throughout their careers. They also have totally different game plans and skill sets, and that's what makes this fight so much fun.
Is it fair to say these are two of the more underrated heavyweights in the division?
100%.
Because I feel like Marcin Tybura has not got the respect he deserves for being on a 5-fight win streak right now, and I know his style might not be the most aesthetically pleasing at all times, but if you look at the newer version of Tybura that we've got throughout his last two performances, he is a much more aggressive fighter than we have seen in the past, and it's been really nice to see out of Tybura because he was one of those kind of decision heavyweights, and there's not many of them out there. I'll clinch you. I'll go for the takedown. If I can't get the takedown, I'll be happy to just sort of clinch with you. And he wasn't the most offensive-oriented fighter out there. I do feel like that's safe to say. But throughout his last five fights, Marcin Tybura has definitely turned a corner. And it's been refreshing to see because it felt like at 34, when he was when he first started his winning streak, he was still sort of the same fighter. He was just fighting a different level of competition. But I really feel like in the Greg Hardy fight and in the Walt Harris matchup, he has shown an improvement of his skills. And that's not often that we see a guy make improvements at the age of 35. It's really, really nice to see out of a heavyweight who, at least I felt like, was set in his ways up until this point. And the flip side, you can say the exact same thing about Alexander Volkov. He was a heavyweight who I thought I knew everything about him. I thought, oh, he's a good striker on the outside. Not great knockout power, but if he hits you clean, he can put you down. But he's got a massive Achilles heel, and that is the wrestling. But what does Alexander Volkov do? He got out wrestled in a main event. It was a big slot. He got, I don't want to say embarrassed, but he was on the wrong side of a one-sided decision. And you know what he did? He didn't just say, hey, I'm going to go back to the gym, work on the same kind of stuff, and next time if I go out there, I might win. He thought, hey, what if I bulk up? What if I work on my takedown defense?
Wrong answer.
And what if I improve on the things that I wasn't doing well up until that point?
The right answer would have been, what if I get a giant stingray on my back?
That's true.
That's really the answer.
He got the samurai over top of the stingray.
Whatever. It's a weird back tattoo chronology that's been for Alexander Volkov. And that's a lot of ink. That's like Sean Brady level ink. Those guys are dedicated. But for Volkov, you're right. His last time out, a 5-round fight against Ciryl Gane. He gets a little bit out kickboxed. He gets a little bit beat. And he loses the decision. And then Gane goes on to fight Blaydes for the interim belt. And now at UFC 270, it's going to be Ngannou versus Gane. Teammate versus teammate. But for now, in this fight, again, it is a really tricky one if you're trying to make a pick. Because Tybura has looked very good. And I think it is really tough for not just you and I, but for a lot of people to try and figure out, okay, where does Marcin fit into this division? Because striking-wise, I mean, the much more accurate striker is Volkov. He's a much longer fighter in this one. He has about 4 inches of height. He has, about four inches in reach. It's not a negligible amount. That much is true. In terms of the takedowns and the activity, that goes the way of Tybura. Now, Volkov's stats are going to be skewed by that Curtis Blaydes fight. But when it comes down to this one, again, Volkov coming off loss, Tybura continues the win streak. Those wins, again, we want to highlight them for Volkov in the five on in. Knocks out Overeem, knocks out Walt Harris, and he's got a knockout, a decision win over Greg Hardy. Tybura was more impressive against Greg Hardy. Wow. Cool. Unranked heavyweight. Cool stuff.
The difference with those numbers, though, and the thing you do have to bring up is that Alexander Volkov at 240 pounds didn't have good takedown defense, and he could get out-muscled by bigger guys in this division. I don't think we would see, at least we wouldn't see the exact same fight out of Blaydes and Volkov if they ever did have a rematch, because I do think there's some positives you could take out of both losses that Volkov has had, because I think it's fair to say he's done as well against Ciryl Gane as anyone has in the UFC up until this point. No one's been able to land clean on Gane like Volkov was able to do. And yes, Volkov's not some crazy power puncher, so just him hitting Gane one time, you were really afraid Gane was going to go down. But I do think there are some positives in that matchup for Volkov. I don't think Tybura has the outside movement of Ciryl Gane. I don't think he has the striking defense of Ciryl Gane. And the thing with Tybura is, He only marches on a straight line. Whether he's moving forwards or backwards, there's no left to right with his movement. And I brought it up with you before we started filming, so I gotta get it out of my mind right now. When Tabor was on his first little run up until his Fabricio Werdum main event, because people forget, Mercer Tabora had a main event slot, like was a pretty hyped up heavyweight, then went on a losing streak, and now he's doing well again. In that first little run, he wasn't beating guys impressively, he was just kind of outlasting them. And it will be really interesting to see if he has the finishing instinct against a guy like Volkov, because I think if Tabora goes out there and gets an early takedown, he will have a lot of success against Volkov. The issue is that we haven't seen anybody have any kind of grappling success against this version or this size of Alexander Volkov. And I really don't think Marcin Tybura can strike on the outside with him. I think Tybura can beat guys in the top 10. I think there's one guy in the top 10 who stylistically Tybura matches up really well with. It's just, in this fight, he's going to have to start his takedown attempts from halfway across the cage, which I think Volkov can pick up on and counter. And I don't think he can strike with Volkov on the feet. I just think stylistically, this is a very poor matchup for Tybura.
Alexander Volkov with like that meter and a half long L step of his. We'll have to see what he's able to bring into this one. The odds for the fight, Volkov open a favorite minus 210, minus 300 right now. For Tybura, open a plus 180. He's a plus 236. The thing with Tybura, though, he's always in your face. Always in your face. So if you can take the range away from Volkov, the long-range weapons, and the kicks, great opportunity for Tybura. The picks on Tapology, wow. 831 total votes. 82% Volkov, 33% by decision, 62% by knockout. For the 18% that have Tybura, 59% by decision. I've got Volkov in this one. I don't know if he's going to be able to get a win by knockout, though. So I would say on this one, fight goes the distance would probably be my, like, question mark kicks pick on this. If I have to pick a fighter, I'm going to go Volkov. But Tybura has a lot more opportunities in this fight than maybe we or a lot of other people are giving him credit for. It's just, yeah, that forward movement, a little tricky. And I think Volkov is going to be the guy to land a lot more volume to.
I think Volkov's going to finish him. I really do. And this is why I say that. Because I like how I brought up the Struve fight and didn't even say the example I was going to. Marcin Tybura, when he moves forward, he's very predictable with his movement. And if you go back and watch the Struve fight, yes, he's having success, especially up against the cage when he's pushing the much taller guy and just sort of like using his elbow under his head, pushing him up. But the problem in that fight, though, he eats a ton of uppercuts and he eats a massive front kick in the second round that doesn't drop him, doesn't knock him out, but it hurts him bad. And listen, Stefan Struve has had odd amounts of success
against Stipe Miocic.
Exactly, and he even looked okay against Alexander Volkov until he didn't. Like, that fight was pretty fun, but when those type of techniques are landing against Marcin Tybura, I could see Alexander Volkov using those exact same techniques and having a lot of success with them. And I know Alexander Volkov hits a whole heck of a lot harder than Struve, so I really like Volkov in this matchup.
Matt, both of us going with Russia's Alexander Volkov to get the win. Big one for Drago with the samurai on his back. Let us know down below in the comments section. You going with Poland here? You going with Russia? We have some big-time fights after this one. Makhachev, Hooker, Jan taking on Sandhagen in the main event. Jan Blachowicz taking on Glover Teixeira. You're not going to want to miss this. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Big time fight coming up this weekend at lightweight. We have the future champion, Islam Makhachev, taking on Dan the Hangman Hooker. And for the Hangman, he took a fight against Nasrat Haqparast not that long ago. It was just, what, a month ago? Yeah, a month ago he took on Haqparast. Extenuating circumstances for both guys. Haqparast, his mother unfortunately passed away due to cancer, so he had to leave the States to go to Europe. Had a hard time coming back over to the States. And for Dan Hooker, the same can be said. He had a hard time leaving New Zealand to get there. They both had a fight, and Dan Hooker put it on. He proved all the doubters wrong. Again, he shored up some of his defensive lapses with his boxing. He really mixed everything well together in that one. He put on a statement Dan Hooker performance like you and I and everybody else out there knows that he can. And you look at the two losses that he had before that, again, to Dustin Poirier in a main event and to Michael Chandler in a giant fight where he gets finished quite quickly. And then the aftermath of that fight, waiting to go back to New Zealand, it was just heartbreaking stuff. Like, you hate to see it. So for Hooker, it seemed like him and the City Kickboxing team, they all kind of took fights in the States at about the same time. The narrative was they would stay in the States. And from Dan Hooker's Instagram, I can see that he spent a little bit of time at Syndicate after his win against Haqparast about a month ago. He is now taking another fight on short notice, replacing Rafael Dos Anjos against Islam Makhachev. And listen, RDA Makhachev's kind of like Tony and Habib. You want it to happen, and then it just keeps not happening. So we get this fight where Makhachev was going to take on a guy who can wrestle, who can box, who can grind on you in RDA, whereas Dan Hooker is a long-range striker. So it is an interesting style switch for both guys, I guess, because for Hooker on short notice, Makhachev's nowhere near the guy that, Hackprast is. The reverse should be said. This is such an interesting stylistic fight where, listen, Adriano Martins beat Islam Makhachev. I think we have to say that every single time out there. Unimpressive knockout. Since then, and before then, Islam Makhachev looks like, I don't know, Ben and Jerry's ice cream to your no-name, end-of-the-freezer $2 bucket that you buy. Night and day different.
I'm going to say this about Dan Hooker before I break this fight down at all. So before he fought Nasrat Hackprast, I mentioned this to you, and you really disagreed with me hard on this, so I feel somewhat validated now. I said, do you think Dan Hooker could become like the next Cowboy Cerrone? And you thought, no, not at all. I'm really happy to see Dan Hooker take this fight and actually go back into the deep end, because I do think Dan Hooker is cut from that cloth of like anyone, anywhere, anytime, any weight. You don't have fights stretching from featherweight to heavyweight throughout your career, not just in MMA, but in just kickboxing too, and not just be down to fight anybody all the time.
Who is he, Gegard Mousasi?
He pretty much, like, Dan Hooker is that guy. He really is. No one is more down to fight than Dan Hooker. I know a lot of people like to think, oh, guys just raise their hands so they like get some, you know, they get a little bit of shine in the media. People think they're you're a badass taking fights on short notice. No, Dan Hooker is that guy. Whether he has to fly across the world while cutting weight on like 2 days notice to fight Nasrat Hackprast, or whether he has to fight Islam Makhachev, probably his worst stylistic matchup in the UFC on 2 weeks notice. Like, enough can't be said about just Dan Hooker and what he is made of, because you kind of know that from his fighting style. There's zero quit in Dan Hooker. Zero quit. I know we brought that up with Makhachev and Amir Khani. Like, when they go
quit in the Barboza fight.
He didn't. He fell down because his organs got turned to mashed potatoes. He got dropped 3 times to get hit by a liver shot. You don't give up when you get hit by liver shots. You fold from them.
Your body gives up.
But that's not a heart issue. Like, Dan Hooker is never going to give up in the cage. And that's the first thing you have to think about when you fight a guy like Islam Makhachev. Because with Makhachev, it's really interesting. He's not a fighter who gets finishes for the sake of finishes. I put him in sort of that, I make you quit and then you give me the submission. Or you give me the TKO from that position. What I'm trying to say is, I don't think Dan Hooker is going to be a fighter who he gets taken down once, he gets taken down twice, can't get back up to his feet, and then just gives up. Like, he gets submitted rear naked choke style in the second round. Dan Hooker is going to put up as much of a fight as he possibly can, and that's why I'm so excited for it. Because with Makhachev, it feels like he's sort of this uncrowned king right now, but there's a lot that we still don't know about. And it's interesting, he had that fight with Thiago Moises and looked phenomenal in it, was able to submit the jiu-jitsu black belt. He looked great. But even with Moises, there's a few questions. Like, is he really, really a top 10, top 15 kind of guy in this weight class? If you're able to go out there and beat a guy like Dan Hooker, it proves that, though. With Moises, there's some question marks. If you beat Dan Hooker, I know exactly what you're made of.
Islam Makhachev right now is on one of those runs where maybe he missed a little bit of time in his career. Now we get to start to progress. He just turned 30, and he's turning on the jets. He beats Drew Dober. He beats Thiago Moises in a main event where you're getting ready for 5 rounds, and then you submit a guy in Moises that... I don't know if there's something that he loves more in life than jiu-jitsu, finishing guys, and being mean-looking than dip. I mean, the guy's always got a lip in. But when I look at this fight, yeah, it's really tough for me to make a case that Dan Hooker's going to win it.
I can't say enough great things about Dan Hooker, the fighter. I really can't. If you like watching fun fights, you probably like watching Dan Hooker. Dan Hooker's what you want a UFC fighter to be. It's just, no matter when, no matter what time, no matter what weight, I'm going to come in to put on a show. It's just... having those, like, really firefight, fan-friendly types of fights don't really bode well when you're fighting a guy like Islam Makhachev, because the second you do start to unload with your strikes and your combinations, that's when he's able to shoot it on your hips. And it would be a different story if Dan Hooker had slightly more one-punch knockout power. Like, yes, he's got one-punch knees, if you will. He's got some one-punch or one-strike capabilities. But with Dan Hooker, it really is a matter of how is he going to get his volume into play. And I think it's going to be really hard to volume strike against a guy like Makhachev, where every time you do let your hands go, he's in on your hips.
The weird thing is on this one, Hooker can strike from either side. Makhachev out of southpaw is going to make it interesting, because how do you really download that game plan if you're Hooker off the hop? Makhachev's going to be right there going at it. And the weird thing is too, the strike differential and the percentages for Makhachev, 70% strike defense, you never see that. 58% strike accuracy, you see it because most of his fights are on the ground and he's hammering away and he's always going for the takedowns. Hooker has 80% takedown defense in the UFC, spread between two weight classes, which is very good. So I really do like this fight. I'm not even going to talk about the odds. I'm not even going to look at the Tapology votes either because I'm sure everything heavily sways Makhachev's favor. It's going to be a really interesting test. I have Russia's Islam Makhachev in this one, and hopefully we get that RDA fight. If we don't, we get like a McGregor, we get like a Poirier-Oliveira, the winner of that fight. Like, I think Makhachev's got to start putting the rubber to the road. The winner, Chandler and Gaethje, like somebody like that.
The issue with Makhachev right now is he doesn't have a name compared to all the top guys at 155 pounds. And it sucks because he should, just based on talent. Don't bring up his Instagram followers.
No, Craig, you just swipe left. You swipe left. We don't want that guy. When the big names see his name slide across the table, they slide it back and say, put the money offer up a little bit.
That's why it's great for him that Dan Hooker is so willing to take this fight, because I do think Dan Hooker is the biggest name opponent he would have been able to get on such short notice. And the RDA fight was one I know we were really excited for. RDA stylistically is a guy who might be able to offer Makhachev just a few different looks. He's slightly better with his grappling, might be a little less dangerous than Hooker on the feet, but you get the idea. Styles make fights. I just think stylistically, it's a really hard matchup for Hooker.
Both of us going with Russia's Islam Makhachev in this fight. And let us know down below in the comments section who you've got in this one. And in our main and co-main title fights, Petr Yan taking on Corey Sandhagen for the interim bantamweight strap. And in the main event, oh boy, at 205 for the belt, Jan Blachowicz taking on Glover Teixeira. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Absolute banger. Coming up in our co-main event this weekend, we have the former champion, and maybe a bit of foreshadowing, maybe a little bit of fun on our part, throwing out the picture of Petr Yan with the belt. He's taking on Corey Sandhagen. Matt, this is such an interesting fight because should it even happen? That's a giant question. Interim belts are silly. So for me to have that tag here, I think it's ridiculous. I mean, TJ Dillashaw beat Sandhagen. It was a very close fight. I scored it 3-2 for Sandhagen. You can make an argument either way. It's an L on his record. Petr Yan's also coming off an L where he was starting to take over in a fight against Aljamain Sterling. He was looking like, I don't know, amazing. And then he lands an illegal knee and Aljamain Sterling puts on a performance, and he's put on a performance on Twitter ever since. And I think it's hilarious. But when I look at it overall, this is a fight that I think needed to happen. Overall, a belt or not, these guys match up so well together, because for Petr Yan, his boxing and his technicality are unmatched. For Corey Sandhagen, it's kind of like the opposite. He's got wonky striking. You don't know where that strike's going to come from because he moves so weird. And listen, I said this in Corey Sandhagen Dillashaw, and a lot of people gave me a lot of flack. They said, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm not going to listen to a single thing you say. I said, I want to hear what Brent Shaw has to say about this fight. And ultimately, it didn't matter. It was just a fun little thing to throw in there because he knows both of those guys very well.
I don't know.
And in that fight, they matched up very well against each other. Dillashaw, off a long layoff, looked very good against Sandhagen. And Sandhagen, while he tends to kind of teeter off a little bit as the fight goes on, he is so dangerous throughout a full 25. That's what makes this one so interesting. It's going to depend on who starts off fast, who can start to win some rounds, and will we ultimately get a finish too?
This is my hot take, Craig. I know we had this on our Fight of the Night screen. I genuinely think this will be Fight of the Year. I really do. And now, Dustin Poirier is fighting Charles Oliveira, and that fight's going to be wild, and I really do think that that fight's going to be like entertainment value 100 out of 10. But right now, I really do think this is the best chance to be the new Fight of the Year, because what Petr Yan brings to the table is absurd boxing technique, really, really sound defensive movement, and also the ability to just flip that violent switch. Like, Petr Yan's a really unique fighter, because when he decides to move forward in that, like, Paulo Costa, Yoel Romero type of a mindset, where it's like, okay, I'm throwing bombs from my hip, and, like, whatever happens, happens, he can fight that type of a fight and still, oddly enough, be sound defensively while he fights that type of a fight. And with Corey Sandhagen, like you had mentioned it, nothing he does is traditional. It's all very wonky. And normally when a fighter is just really unique in that aspect, it's because that their skills aren't great, so they have to be different to set themselves apart. Corey Sandhagen isn't that type of a fighter. He has such great fundamentals that it really allows him a sort of freedom with his striking game. And I know that was very Robin Black, but I'm going to bring us back. What Corey Sandhagen's able to do on the feet is something that no other fighter in this weight class really does to the best of their abilities, and that's feint on the outside. Now, the other fighter who does that is TJ Dillashaw, and it's really weird because I think the Dillashaw-Yan fight would look very similar to what the Sandhagen-Yan fight will, and Piotr Yan's kind of getting the best case scenario right now. I know he lost his belt via disqualification, but they're giving him another chance at the belt. Right now, the UFC is acting like that fight never happened, because if Piotr Jan beats Corey Sandhagen and does it impressively, I can almost guarantee you they're going to market the Jan-Sterling rematch as, well, Piotr Jan basically won that first fight. Like, just this is one of those fights where the UFC, it's a win-win situation no matter what. If Sandhagen wins, it's very easy to market the rematch between him and Sterling because the first fight was over so fast. And same thing with Jan. If he's able to get a big win, you can kind of erase that no contest to Sterling and we can just pretend like the division's moving back on like normal.
Well, when we look at this one for Sandhagen, I threw the link out there on Reddit and then a lot of people commented under it. And I had to follow up with a comment of my own because a lot of people were surprised that Sandhagen's working with two of Rufus Sports' best in and around this division in Sergio Pettis and Ralphion Stotts. And I remember Sandhagen getting ready for Dillashaw saying the same thing because he's been working with them for a while now. This is not new whatsoever. And they've been training at elevation. All things to like about Corey Sandhagen because for Sergio, he's going to give you different looks from different stances with great boxing, similar to what Piotr Jan can do. And then the other X factor that Jan has that Pettis has a little bit, but Ralphion Stotts has in droves is the fact that he can just wrestle all day and not give up. And I think Stotts, he's in such an interesting spot in Bellator because he's kind of come out and said, well, if I have to fight my teammate, I will for the belt. And I can't wait to see that happen. But both of those guys, A, being friends, and B, being friends with Sandhagen to the point where they can get into that training partner status, that's awesome for a guy like that. For Piotr Jan, it's going back to the basics, working your striking, getting with your coaches, and just figuring out how not to make a mistake like that. He's only has one other loss in his career against Magomed Magomedov, a very good fighter with Bellator now. And what happened?
He avenged it?
Well, he avenged it, and he did exactly what you said. He walked him down and just went in there like a man possessed. I fully expect that out of Piotr Jan in this fight. And now Corey Sandhagen has something to prove off of a loss where he needs to get a win. With a win, you win the belt and an automatic shot, one would think, for the real title against Sterling whenever that might happen.
So I'm going to bring up a point that I brought up on the Sterling-Jan fight. And it's not to pat myself on the back or act like I'm really good at this or any means, but what I said was that the problem Sterling has, especially with his striking, is he just does a lot of it, right? He's always throwing punches from the outside, he's throwing kicks, he's giving his opponent something to look at. And I'm a big believer in, why would I let you know anything about my game that I don't have to? And what the issue I found that Sterling was going to have in the fight with Jan, and he ended up having it, was he kind of showed Jan everything he could in the first 6 minutes of that fight. So once Jan was able to download the range, download some of the movement of Sterling, you were able to tell that Jan was able to just meet him with power every single time. All that flashiness is great, but if I just go straight down the middle with power shots, and if I'm able to time you on the half beat consistently, I'll have a lot of success. And once Jan really did start to let his hands go, you saw, when he hit Sterling, Sterling would hit the ground, and then Jan would just walk him back up, and that was basically the fight over and over again. I worry a little bit about Sandhagen as this fight progresses, because early on in this fight, I think Sandhagen can have a lot of success with his unique movement, darting in, darting out, switching stances, because all of that is movement and striking that Piotr Jan is unfamiliar with. But the big key to this fight is, how active is Sandhagen going to be with all that movement and being unorthodox with his strikes early on? Because if he gives Piotr Jan all of his game right away, then I don't care how flashy you are. Jan will eventually download your game plan, keep those hands right up by his head like they're supposed to be, and just march you down. And I can see Jan probably knocking out Sandhagen. I know that's wild to say. Sandhagen has a wild chin, but I do think Jan has that type of punching power. Now, the flip side of that is, Sterling did have pretty good success when he was able to put his volume together with Jan. What you'll notice with Piotr Jan is that, yes, defensively he's very sound, but he's a guy who'll just kind of keep his hands up and look. Now, I really like the fact that he does look through his guard. It's not all just hands up and we'll see what happens. But when you do just keep your hands up, that's when a guy like Sandhagen target your legs, target your body. That's when he can get really unorthodox with his strikes and really put the pain on Piotr Jan. That's why I think this fight's so fun, because both guys have honestly a pretty clear roadmap to get the win, but you know it's not going to be that simple.
Corey Sandhagen, one of the wonkiest, longest guys at 135 pounds. It's like Will Chope if he figured it out. It's like Bobby Green if he was Super Factor in Madden. That's the kind of skills that Corey Sandhagen has. He could shoulder roll. He can do some crazy stuff. I absolutely love it. We look at the odds for this one. Jan, open the favorite, minus 300, minus 248 right now. For Sandhagen, open to plus 250, plus 201 or thereabouts on best fight odds. The votes for this one, 767 of them on Tapology, 78% Jan, 64% by decision, 29% by knockout. For the 22% that have Sandhagen, 48% by decision, 43% by knockout. Piotr Jan's one of my guys, and when I started Fight Night Picks in 2018, Piotr Jan was a guy that I said, you know, you got to watch this guy, potential title implications
he's impressive in you
in the UFC. It's just like, who else? Brandon Moreno, Fight Night Picks, future champ Santa 2020. Luque. We just had to wait a little bit longer. I think Piotr Jan's got this one. Sandhagen's another very, very tough test. If I look at the last four wins for Jan, John Dodson, Jimmy Rivera, Uriah Faber, and then Jose Aldo, all of those guys bring, well, actually kind of a similar skill set. They're stocky, they're shorter, they can punch very well, they can do a lot of things incredibly well, and they have speed. Sandhagen's different from those guys. Like, he does bring in a totally different element, so we'll see if Piotr Jan can figure it out. I think he's going to be able to download the game plan after the first round and a half, end of the second round, and then we bank the third, fourth, and fifth. It's a dangerous game because Sandhagen in his last fight against Dillashaw, same thing. Guy with the lower center gravity for Dillashaw, he was able to figure things out. If he was, again, you can agree to disagree on that one, but I like Jan in this one.
So the last thing I'll say and the comp for the fight that I'll bring up, I think this fight's going to look a lot like Poirier versus Dan Hooker, where Corey Sandhagen, the longer ranger guy who uses a lot more kicks, is going to have success early. He is the more active guy out of these two, or at least he is on a... I would say he's more stable with his output throughout a round, because with Jan, it is a lot of like, okay, he won't really do much for a couple of minutes, so kind of get his feel, but once he flips that switch and finally becomes like the offensive dynamo he can, that's when you really have to watch your P's and Q's, because he has absurd power and volume and just really good technique too. Like, when you look at Piotr Jan, nothing really jumps out of the page as, oh, that is a weakness that he possesses. He's got great takedown defense. He's great defensively on the feet. I don't think anyone's going to take Jan's belt unless it is a disqualification, so there's my pick.
Matt, both of us going with Russia's Piotr Jan in this one. If you disagree or if you agree, let us know down below in the comments section. We're going to be live here on YouTube with the Fight Companion for the main card portion, so you can watch along with us. It should be a lot of fun. And listen, we have a big-time main event coming up. Jan Blachowicz taking on Glover Teixeira. So let's move on over there. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Like 3 years ago, if you sat me down and said that we'd have a fight for the light heavyweight championship between Jan Blachowicz and Glover Teixeira, I would tell you to get out of here. You're just full of it, buddy. But that's what we have coming up this weekend. UFC 267, Jan Blachowicz looking to make a second straight title defense at 205 pounds, taking on a great coach in Brazil's Glover Teixeira out of Connecticut. How crazy is all of this? But Matt, I absolutely love this fight. It should be a great one. I want to hear from everybody who their picks are on this one, because you've been forewarned. The odds are skewed one way more so than the other. But I see this being a very close fight on paper, and it's crazy to think that your champion is close to being 39. Your challenger will have just turned 42 this week. Matt, wild that this fight's happening in 2021.
Glover Teixeira is almost twice as old as I. Like, Glover Teixeira could be my dad, and it wouldn't be a surprise whatsoever. Like, that's how old these two fighters are. But the great thing is, they're not... That sounds terrible. It's not, like, a bad type of age, though. These are two fighters who have really gained a lot from the experiences in the cage, and that's why I'm so excited for this matchup, because I don't think we're getting two fighters who are near the end of their primes. I think we're getting two fighters who have just learned a lot throughout their lives and just so happen to be fighting near the end of their fighting primes. And this has been really weird. Now, I'm going to give it back to you right away. Have you heard anyone bring up Glover Teixeira's fight with Jon Jones in the last, like, 3 weeks? Because I haven't. It feels like everyone is treating this like it's Glover Teixeira's first title shot. And it's like, oh, wow, what a beautiful moment this is. Teixeira at 42 is finally getting his chance. Guys, he fought for the title. People forget how hyped up Glover Teixeira was on his initial UFC run. It's kind of like, your boy Volkan Oezdemir. I don't know why I said your boy, but it's kind of like Volkan Oezdemir, where people forget the initial success he had and only remember some of the losses. But Glover Teixeira was that boogeyman outside the UFC who Chuck Liddell would talk about all the time, being like, hey, I know this Brazilian guy is going to be champ one day. And everyone sort of joked it off and laughed it off, but Glover Teixeira has been around for a very, very long time, and he's never got the respect he deserves.
Outside of the UFC, Glover beat, and I'm not joking, Marvin Eastman by knockout and Rico Rodriguez, former UFC champion. He comes in, he beats Cliff's brother, Kyle Kingsbury. He beats Fabio Maldonado. He beats Rampage. He beats James Tahuna. He beats Ryan Bader, your Bellator heavyweight champion currently. And then he loses to Jones at UFC 172 by decision. Then he loses to Phil Davis, a great wrestler. He beats OSP, beats Durkin, Pat Cummins. And I gotta say this, because I saw these news headlines come out this week. I think it was a Bleacher Report article, but I can't confirm or deny. So we'll just say, I think it was, but I'm not sure. I think it was Bleacher Report.
Okay.
That Durkin, was he the second coming? Was he the guy that was going to beat John Jones?
No.
Crazy. Then he beats Rashad Evans. He loses to Johnson and so on and so forth. But the run that Glover's on right now, Carl Roberson, Iwan Kutsalaba, Nikita Krylov, Anthony Smith, where he punched his teeth in, and then Thiago Santos, where they have a back and forth fight. It was a lot of fun. And Glover submits him in the third round for Jan, the last five fights, because he had his own crazy career where it looks like, hey, he lost a bunch, he's gone. Knocks out Luke Rockhold, left hook Larry.
Beautiful shot.
Beats Jacare Souza by split decision. Awful fight.
Terrible.
Beats Beeston 25-8, who stopped the presses or hold the presses. Since that loss, has just continued his win streak and looked amazing.
I would like Blachowicz in the rematch if they ever fought a third time.
And I'd like Beeston 25-8, but he beats him in Rio Rancho in front of your former champion, that guy. And then they're going to fight, but then they don't. Then he fights Dominic Reyes, finishes him, and then his last time out fights Israel Adesanya, where he fought a Jan Blachowicz fight, and he looked amazing in that one. So both of these guys, strengths and weakness-wise, they play into each other so well. If you like the Santos fight against Glover, you're going to like this fight. If you like Jan against, I don't know, pick a fighter, you're going to like this fight. I see this one being a lot of fun. Even though these guys are late in their fighting careers, they can still put on fun performances, and I think this is going to be one of those.
Does Glover Teixeira have the best 40-year-old chin you've ever seen? Okay, maybe not. I'm sure there's some guy out there who's been in 1,000 bar fights,
It got checked by Santos, and then he comes back and submits him.
That's what I mean. Most people don't go like, okay, I've eaten an overhand left from Thiago Santos. Most people fall asleep after that. Glover Teixeira doesn't fall asleep. He immediately gets into mount and chokes the other guy out. Like, that's the type of resilience we're talking about when we talk about Glover Teixeira. You have to take this guy down if you want him out of there. Like, you've really got to hit him with a hard shot and put him away. This is a really interesting fight with Jan Blachowicz, and this is the key that I always think about in my head. For Glover to win this fight, of course he needs the takedown. You didn't need to watch our video to know this, but it's going to be really interesting to see how Glover attempts to get the takedowns, because he's a very boxing-heavy fighter, so he finds himself on the inside of the range with his opponent very often. It's going to be interesting, though, to see whether or not Jan Blachowicz throws kicks in this fight, because he relies a lot on his body kicks, and you don't just have to watch the Dominic Reyes performance. I know a lot of people are going to look at that fight, look at the bruising he caused on Reyes' side, but the body kicks have long been a really good weapon for Jan Blachowicz, and I don't think that's a weapon he's going to be able to use a lot in this fight, because if you start kicking Glover consistently to the body, I mean, Glover's been in, 39 professional fights, and he has great fight IQ, too. Let me make sure that that's very clear. He's going to be able to grab one of those kicks, take Jan down, and that's the best position for Glover Teixeira. It's going to be interesting, because a lot of people have said, oh, if Teixeira gets him down, he should be able to have success right away. I think Jan Blachowicz is a good enough defensive grappler to where he won't be in good positions on the mat, but he can at least keep his head out of danger from some of those really bad ground and pound shots that we know Teixeira's great with. And I do think Jan Blachowicz is a good enough defensive grappler to avoid the submission attempts from Teixeira. The flip side is going to be really interesting, though. How does Teixeira get on the inside of the range of Blachowicz?
You got to look at the fact that, does he throw kicks? Not so much. Does he overextend in some of his punches? Yeah, sometimes. Do both guys move straight forward and backwards? Well, if you ever watch Jan Blachowicz, Thiago Santos, you know that, yes, that is the answer. But so does Teixeira. So that's the thing. Can Glover go in there, box his way into a clinch, drop down to get the takedown? Glover's one of those guys. He's not here by mistake. No. He's the type of guy that, so late in his career, mixes in the wrestling with the grappling, with the striking, and coaches a lot of high-level fighters in Connecticut, a lot of Brazilians that have made the move. So in this one, I just have a hard time seeing Teixeira closing that distance. Can it be done? Yeah, I mean, Jan was on that big losing streak before he went on this win streak. He lost to Thiago Santos. That's why I say, if you asked me 3 years ago that these guys would fight for this belt, I'd probably laugh and say, you're crazy, but it's going to happen. The odds for this one, Blachowicz open to minus 190 favorite. He's a minus 276 or thereabouts on best fight odds. For Teixeira, open to plus 165. He's a plus 222. Matt, I've taken enough underdogs on this card. Is this going to be the one? The votes on Tapology, 890, 85% Blachowicz, 79% by knockout. For the 15% that have Teixeira, 61% by submission. To the fans, it's cut and dry. The odds makers, everybody's got Blachowicz. Do you have Teixeira here?
I don't. I actually really like Jan Blachowicz in this matchup, and I think it's one of his more favorable matchups in the division, or at least in the near future, because if you look at the next couple contenders in line, you've got guys like Yuri Prochazka, and even if you're a big Jan Blachowicz or Yuri guy, that's as close to a 50-50 fight as there is. Both guys have big power, both guys are very technical. It's really hard to be confident in either one of them. But with Glover, I really do think he needs that offensive takedown to have a lot of success in this fight. Even look back at Jan's last fight against Israel Adesanya. Adesanya's as good of a pure striker as you can possibly get in the UFC, and he's able to throw a lot of feints at Jan, but what Jan's really good at is not overcommitting to the feints, and he's really good at picking out when you commit to the shot and when you're just trying to make him think that you're throwing fake punches. With Glover, he's all in with a lot of his strikes, and I do see it's going to look kind of the flip side. I actually see him rushing Jan Blachowicz, and I see Jan fighting more of a Thiago Santos kind of a game. I see him striking backwards, and I think there's more than enough chance of him catching Glover with a big shot.
I see this one a little bit like Jorgen De Castro when he fought over in Australia. We're getting the knockout over Justin Taffa. Like, just on the way in, boom goes the dynamite. I've got Jan Blachowicz in this fight. If you can make a good argument, we want to hear from you. We also want to hear from you over on Question Mark Kick and the Fight Companion, the Fight Watch Along over on Saturday. Make sure you subscribe to the channel. If you like the content, toss us one of those. It definitely helps out. And tell your friends. Yeah. We really want to grow this thing. And at 30,000 subscribers, we're going to add a new show for you. We're going to break down Dana White's Contender Series. If you missed any of the videos, the individuals come out as the week goes along. You can find the merch at fightnightpicks.com. There's a lot of great stuff over there as well. And if you're not checking out the website, What are you doing? You can find us at Fight Name Picks on Instagram, at Craig Allen FNP, at Matt Allen FNP. It is a great card, and I can't wait for it to get going. So as we always say with Fight Name Picks, let's get into it.